This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Mr. Earl Hobbs. We're accompanied by Kim Sawyer. We are in the Preston Smith Room in the Special Collections Library on the 16th of January, 2000, at approximately 5 minutes until 2 o'clock. This interview is part of the Lubbock Area Vietnam Veterans Oral History Project. Mr. Hobbs, why don't you begin by telling us where you were born, when and where you were born, and where you grew up.
Okay. My birth date is the first day of June, 1941. And I hate to start with a joke, but I'm not sure whether I was born in Fort Worth or whether it was in Dallas. My parents adopted me and as a baby, a very, very small baby. And we understand from the birth certificate that I was born in Dallas. But the adoption apparently took place in Fort Worth, and so there was some confusion there at one point. Mm-hmm. We're not sure. I think it was Dallas.
Okay.
And what was the rest of that question?
Well, where did you grow up?
Grew up in Lubbock. Mm-hmm. My mother and dad moved from Littlefield to New Deal, where he had bought a cotton gin, mm-hmm. and we lived there. We lived moved from Littlefield to New Deal, and then in 1946 we moved into Lubbock, 3305 24th Street.
Okay.
Which at that time was the last paved street south.
Mm-hmm. And what did your mother do?
My mother was, she was a homemaker, it's the old-fashioned term, mm-hmm. and she was a school teacher before she got married, and she was pretty well educated. She had a degree from Texas Tech and studied at, I've forgotten, someplace in Chicago. I can't think of the name of it. Moody Institute, I believe, in Chicago, if I'm not mistaken. So, and she taught school, but she was basically a homemaker all of her life.
And did your father go to school as well as college?
My father graduated from Tech at about the same time as my mother, and I'm not sure what year, roughly 1934, 35, in that time frame.
Mm-hmm. And what did your parents major in, do you recall?
My mother was liberal arts of some kind, and my father had a Bachelor of Science in, I don't know.
Okay.
I just don't know.
And when you moved to Lubbock, did he stay in the same profession?
Yeah.
What did he do here?
He was a cotton ginner. All of his work, well, he was the principal of schools in Littlefield. And then they got married. He was managing a cotton gin and also running a meat locker plant in Littlefield. I guess in addition to working for the schools, I'm not sure about that. And then he bought the gin at New Deal with his brother and subsequently bought out his brother out of the business. And he operated that gin all of his life. And he also had, not all of his life, but all of his working career. He retired in 64, 65. And he also had interest in Service Compress and Warehouse here in Lubbock, which is now part of Lovecott. And he had several other business interests. He had farm properties, and he had some just some other just general investments here in town.
Do you recall if it was a very competitive business?
Yeah, very competitive business.
Were there co-ops at that time?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was competing with...
Yeah, he was competing directly with co-ops. And in mm-hmm. fact, the reason he got out of the ginning business and retired from it was because one day a bunch of his customers that had been his customers mm-hmm. came in and sat down in the gin office and said, Earl, if you don't sell out to us, we're going to build a gin right straight across the road from you. So he said, I'll sell. Named his price, and they made it. And,
wow.
And... So he got out of the ginning business and stayed in the compress business mm-hmm. with some other men, old names around Lubbock had been in the compress business for years.
Mm-hmm.
And he stayed in business with them for a long time. And then my dad passed away in August of 81. And I kind of took over what business he had at that time and continued that until we just finished it up this past year, finished dissolving everything out and closing up the trusts and that mm-hmm. sort of thing.
Did it remain a competitive industry?
The cotton business?
Yeah, everything that you were involved with, the press?
Yeah, pretty much so. The compress business, we got out of that in service compress and warehouse, sold to, the corporation was sold to Lovecot, which is from Lovington, New Mexico, and they have compress through the area here. And that's a very competitive business mm-hmm. to be in. They sold that in, started to say, about 1997. I may be missing a year or so there, plus or minus a couple of years, but approximately. I've forgotten exactly, but it hasn't been all that long ago. Mm-hmm. A few years.
Okay. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I have one sister.
Okay.
Yeah, she's 2 years younger than I am. And she's married, lives in Tyler, Texas. Actually, just southwest of Tyler. A tiny little place called Noonday.
Was she adopted
they're,
also?
They're famous for their onions in Noonday.
Oh, Noonday.
No,
okay.
No. She was, she's the my mother and father's child.
Okay. And how old were you when she was born?
2.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What types of activities did you engage in as a young boy and a young teenager growing up in Lubbock?
Well, I guess the typical things here. I've never been the athletic type, although you have to compete in sports a little bit. I guess I played a little football and that sort of thing, but not anything significant.
Mm-hmm.
My dad always saw to it that I worked at the gin in the summertime, and even during the ginning season in the winter, he would occasionally say, "I need you to work a night shift." And when I was in junior high and high school, well, I've driven tractor all night long, pulling trailers, you know. So he saw to it that I learned how to work at an early age.
How old were you when you started that?
Probably about in the range of 14, 15, I guess. And I continued that up through at least through high school. Mm-hmm. Through high school.
Did you get paid?
We lived pretty well.
Okay.
Yeah, we lived pretty well. He didn't pay me as such, although I got plenty of money. I had enough spending money.
Okay.
We were affluent, not wealthy, but comfortable, very comfortable family. Mm-hmm. I was very fortunate in that regard.
How old were you when you got your first car?
About a junior in high school, I guess.
Was it common for juniors around Lubbock to have cars, or was that kind of an exception?
I don't think it was the exception at all. I think a lot of us did. There were two high schools at that time, Lubbock High School and Monterey were the only two. Monterey was a brand new school, and I think Monterey was a little bit more the upscale school. The funny part about it is I went to Monterey. My sister went to Lubbock High School because they changed the boundary. The year that I was a sophomore, they changed the boundary, and I thought I was going to have to go to Lubbock High School when I was a junior, but they didn't. I stayed in Monterey, but my sister went to Lubbock High School. The direct answer to your question about the car is probably more kids at Monterey had cars than at Lubbock High School. But I don't think that it was unusual for a kid to mm-hmm. have a car at all.
Okay.
It was just very common.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as extracurricular activities, growing up, I played in the orchestra. I played viola.
Mm-hmm.
I started playing the Lubbock Symphony when I was in high school, really in junior high. I guess my last year of junior high, and played in the Lubbock Symphony all through high school and college. And I worked for the conductor, Bill Harrod, at that time was the conductor of the Lubbock Symphony, and I worked mm-hmm. in his music store when I was at Tech. So that's what I did.
Okay. Now, when you were working for your dad, doing the cotton gin work, were there a lot of accidents and some of the problems with ginning even now, hands and things getting caught in the gin and things of that nature? Were
ginning,
there still problems then?
Yeah, ginning is a dangerous game. It's dangerous because there's an awful lot of exposed machinery. And just as an example, a cotton gin stand where the cotton comes down in a bat into the gin stand and goes through the ginning process where the seed is extracted from the lint.
Mm-hmm.
Really, it's more properly the lint's extracted from the seed. But there are a lot of saws that are running through ribs.
Mm-hmm.
The saw comes through and runs through this rib. And it's very easy, as an example, just as an example type, to get your fingers or hand caught in there.
Mm-hmm.
My dad lost his small finger and thumb in a ginning accident. They used to use very common. I learned how to do this as a kid. I mean, I just grew up doing it. It was just the thing. I mean, that's what I did. We used to use a stick about this long, about maybe 18 inches long, and little piece of one inch wide, quarter of an inch thick, and that's what you cleaned out, what you called a dog inside a gin stand, which was cotton that had become balled up on the inside of the stand. And his accident was from just exactly that sort of thing. And some people would make a mistake and try to clean out a dog with a piece of wire rather than a stick. A soft pine stick will just be cut by the saws, but a wire is caught and it can yank off fingers and things like that. You learn not to wear a ring around a gin.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an awful lot of exposed belts and all kinds of dangerous equipment. But I grew up around it and he taught me what to do and what not to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you also picked it up just by watching other people. It's like anything else.
Mm-hmm.
It's a type of work.
But certain hazards that are not necessarily common.
That's right, yeah. Farming's very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you farm or did your family farm other?
He had farms,
mm-hmm.
and I grew up, you know, in the cotton. I just grew up in the cotton business.
Mm-hmm.
He was a ginner, but he had farms, and I grew up. If it had to do with cotton, well, he had to do with it,
mm-hmm.
and so I knew the business pretty well many years ago.
Did you farm anything else besides cotton?
No. Well, you nearly always grow a little grain.
Okay.
What
kind
of
grain?
Grain sorghums.
Okay.
Maize, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how about just vegetables and stuff for
gardens? That's about it. Just family
small
type
gardens.
Yeah.
Okay. Did your sister help with those types of activities?
No, she was more. She's more, I guess, more like my mother. She was not too interested in the farms and that sort of thing. I think she's pretty typical for her generation, kind of like I was typical for mine. I was not a very good student in school, terrible student in school.
Mm-hmm.
My sister was always made good grades, and she's smarter than I am. I mean, you know, just face it. You just have to be. Sometimes you got to be truthful. She's smarter than I am.
What was your favorite subject in school?
I don't know. It's a hard question to answer.
Was it music or?
I liked music. Yeah, very much. I enjoyed music. I studied architecture at Tech, but I can't say that I had any major things that I was particularly interested in.
Mm-hmm.
I started when I was probably, I guess, a freshman in college. I started learning how to fly. That would have been 1959 or 60. I've kind of forgotten now. And got a pilot's license and got a commercial pilot and instrument rating and instructor's rating and multi-engine and all that kind of stuff. And I guess that's where I sort of drifted away from school, which I didn't have a great interest in to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So then my interests gravitated that direction.
And you were enrolled in Tech immediately after graduating from high
right.
school?
Just, you know, it's the usual thing when you're a kid. You get out of high school. What are you going to do now? Well, I'm going to go to college, you know.
Mm-hmm. What year was that?
I graduated in May of 59 mm-hmm. from Monterey.
Some interesting international events occurred while you were in high school and as you were growing up. You might not have been old enough to remember the success of the communist revolution in China.
Yeah, I do, as a matter
of fact. You do? Mm-hmm. What do you remember about that?
Well, of course, I was real young because we're talking 1949,
yes, sir.
Roughly.
Yes, sir.
And I guess the Long March was in, what, 47, 48? Mm-hmm. I remember reading about it. I was interested in it. And of course, I was always brought up to believe that communism was this huge, massive, monolithic thing that was terrible and was going for world dominance, which mm-hmm. I suppose in a way it was. And so, of course, I saw it from the perspective of a kid in West Texas as being a very bad thing. And I remember the Korean War. Started in late 50 and went through, what, 52 or 53, something like that. I've forgotten now. And so that was a big event. I've answered your question, but I'm not.
there are a lot of
things from that era that I kind of remember. Yeah, I remember. You have pictures in your mind. I have pictures in my mind of people like Stalin and Churchill. You know, when you're that tall, or you know what I'm saying, there are things that stick with you for the rest of your life. And yeah, I remember things like that. Sure.
Was an awareness and interest in current events something that your parents cultivated in you, or?
I think so. My mother and father were not political people in the sense that they didn't actively participate in politics. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Although my dad, I think, made some political contributions to friends and things like that. As an example, we're sitting in the Preston Smith room. Preston Smith was, I understand, was his roommate in college.
Okay.
I find that interesting.
Yes.
And there's, I noticed down there, I was talking with the young lady, Marshall Formby, that mm-hmm. is this pavilion, I guess, is, well, he was a friend of my dad's in college. And,
okay.
And I knew Marshall from up in the Panhandle for years.
Wow.
But I, you know, as a kid,
mm-hmm.
you know, a friend of my dad.
Mm-hmm.
They were not political people, but they kept us. I was aware of what was going on because I think my mother and father were aware of what was going on.
Okay.
And we didn't talk politics. We didn't talk current events. But I think it was just something that we were aware of as a family. And like I said, they were pretty well educated people. I don't consider myself to be uneducated just because I don't have a degree, but they were well educated and well informed, and it rubbed off on my sister and on me too.
Mm-hmm. Other significant events that occurred in the 50s, of course, there was the Hungarian uprising.
Yes.
When these types of things occurred, major international events, did they become topics of discussion in your family?
Yes, they did, as a matter of fact. And then the Hungarian uprising was kind of an interesting thing. My grandfather, on my mother's side, his name was R.C. Hopping. He was a rather prominent judge here in West Texas. He had been a... he's a very self-educated man, and he'd become an attorney, and I don't know, he had a lot of different things, and became a judge. And when the Depression hit, he went to work for an outfit called the Elwood Estates, which you may or may not be familiar with. I think they're still in existence, and one of their objectives was to finance the maintenance of a lot of these large ranches out in this area, the Spade Ranch, the Bell Ranch, and places like that. And if they had to be broken up, well, it was part of the Elwood. They wanted to be the people that broke them up so that they could try to keep as much of this land intact as possible. And my grandfather was a very, very prominent man. Mm-hmm. And when the Hungarian Revolution broke out in was it 58 or 59?
I think it was, like I said, earlier.
59, I guess. That doesn't quite sound right to me. But
I
anyway,
think 57.
But 57, might have been. But anyway, he and my grandmother... they lived on the northwest side of Lubbock at that time between Lubbock and Shallow Water, and they brought some Hungarian refugees here. A man and his wife, and I am under the impression some other people. They sponsored them, and this man's name was Effie. I remember that was what we called him, was Effie, and he had obviously a Hungarian last name, which I don't remember at all. And I was again a kid, and. They brought these people there, and they lived there for quite a long period of time. Quite a long period of time. I'm reaching back, but that's mm-hmm. And I hope I've got my chronology correct, but yeah. That's about right.
It's an interesting story. Yeah. Was that? Did anybody else bring over Hungarian refugees that you know of? Or
I don't know.
Kind of sounds like a pretty unique. Experience for this part of the country.
I think maybe my aunt and uncle, who lived out there at that time, may have. I may be getting my chronology wrong, but I think that's the time frame that I'm thinking about. And I know that these people were Hungarian, mm-hmm. and I believe that they came over here as a result of that. But I keep thinking that they may have come as early as maybe 50. So it might have been before the revolution, but I know mm-hmm. that the Hungarian Revolution made a big impact. Mm-hmm. Not a big impact, but I remember it mm-hmm. because of these people that were with my grandmother and grandfather at the time, mm-hmm. and perhaps they came over before the revolution.
Okay,
but yeah.
Of course, one of the biggest events, late 50s, was the launching of Sputnik. How was that covered here in Lubbock, and what do you recall about that event?
Well, it was a big news story. I don't remember too much about it, to tell you the truth. I remember it was a big news story, and I remember you'd see on the television at that time was not. I don't remember how many channels Lubbock had. Probably the three basic networks mm-hmm. was about what it had at the time. And I remember seeing these pictures of this funny-looking thing circling the Earth, and I thought it was kind of humorous. But I don't think it made that big an impact because, as a kid, I think we sort of expected that to occur mm-hmm. at some time. I mean, after all, the U.S. Was already working toward that very slowly. I think was it the Vanguard project that was that before or after Sputnik? But it seems to me like Vanguard was about that time frame, and it had some of these projects were already started, but they just weren't going. They just weren't spun up and rolling along real fast. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. It had an impact, but out here in West Texas, well, that didn't make too much of a not too much of a splash.
Okay.
Probably the preachers mentioned it in church.
Speaking of sermons, how about the concern over nuclear Armageddon? Okay, was that something talked about? The fear of atomic war?
I think people here were not. I don't think it was a major concern. If you go around older Lubbock, you'll find very few bomb shelters. Whereas, and I think in some larger cities, and big cities especially, and you might find a lot of them. But here in Lubbock, it never was a thing. It just wasn't much. I only know of one family that, if I remember correctly, built a bomb shelter. But I think that's the only one, and I think they built it more as a cellar, mm-hmm. to for storage.
Mm-hmm.
But It wasn't a big thing. People, I think, in those days, I don't believe there was the hysteria, quote unquote, that you read about. I think there was concern. But we weren't near any major installations. Reese Air Force Base was just a training base. Webb Air Force Base at Big Springs was a training base. The nearest nukes to us were Amarillo. They had B-36s maybe, or B-47s maybe at the time. And then Fort Worth, they had Carswell Air Force Base, which was B-36s. You're too young to know what a B-36 was, but those were... I just don't think there was that feeling of panic or hysteria or that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I've always seen pictures of this duck and cover routine,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I don't have any recollection of that at all. I know what it was, but I don't have any recollection. We never had any drills that I recall or mm-hmm. anything of that nature.
How about tornado drills, though?
No, I don't think so. I've seen a lot of black clouds come over Lubbock, and I don't ever recall that. We in junior high, grade school, we had the usual fire drills, you know, which I guess took the place also of a tornado drill. I don't know, except of course you would run outside. The answer is no, I don't think so.
Do you have any questions before we press on? Okay.
Typical West Texas childhood.
Well, interesting. No, you had moved away from school and gone into piloting.
Well, I hadn't moved away. I was here in Lubbock.
Right. I mean, but I guess you would. But I mean, as your interest had shifted.
Yeah.
You were initially in school working on an architecture degree.
Right.
And eventually, you stopped going to school and pursued piloting full time.
Right.
And you worked for a company. West Tex Aircraft.
Which was, at that time, it was the Piper dealer and wholesaler,
uh-huh.
Piper Aircraft dealer and wholesaler for, well, really for all of this area, stretching from the Big Bend all the way up into southwestern Kansas, really. And big outfit.
Mm-hmm.
Operator's name was Roy Neal. Big name in aviation out in this part of the country.
In what point, or how old were you when you got your pilot's license?
Well,
what year was that?
I got my private license probably in 60.
Okay.
I'd have to go back and look at my book, my log books, if I can find them. But I probably got my private license in 60, 1960, and within a year I had a commercial rating, commercial license, and mm-hmm. then I got an instrument rating. Not too long after that, and instructor rating and multi-engine, they kind of follow, you know, like that. West Tex was pretty good about giving me some flying time. That I would ferry airplanes for them here and there, and I'd build up some time.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I became eligible to have the time and that sort of thing, and the qualifications for the next rating, well, I'd go out and get that. So they came along pretty quickly over that period of time frame. I had most of my licenses by the end of 64, I'm sure.
Okay. What were you initially trained on?
First Air Force? Piper Colt, which is called a PA-22-108, which had a four-cylinder Lycoming engine, fixed pitch prop. It's a little tri-facer type airplane, except it doesn't have the rear seat in it. And a neat little airplane. Kind of weak out in this altitude out mm-hmm. here in the summertime,
mm-hmm.
but it's a good airplane, good trainer, and I learned flying a Colt. We flew Piper Cherokees, we flew Comanches, when I got my multi-engine rating, I was flying twin Comanches, Apaches, Aztecs, that sort of thing. Later on, I flew some other larger airplanes.
And correct me if I'm wrong. Most of these are tricycle gear aircraft?
Yeah, they're most of them. And then I flew some conventional airplanes, too. Crop dusters. I did a little crop dusting at one time.
Okay.
And flew things like Super Cubs. The usual Luscombe's and Taylor Craft and all that kind of stuff. And but Super Cubs were real common back in those days. And I flew a Pawnee, which is a crop duster. I flew a Stearman, which is a crop duster. PT-17, I think, was the military designation. Old Stearman. And I even flew a Twin Beach at one time. It was an interesting old airplane, the Model 18, which was had two Pratt & Whitney radial engines on it, and it was a tailwheel type airplane, mm-hmm. conventional gear airplane. Mm-hmm. And it was a bear to fly. You flew it until you got the chocks under the wheels. You know, you stood there kind of shaking and until you got the chocks under the wheels, and then you could calm down. But, at least it was that way for me.
Did you also get your turboprop rating? Or
I've flown some turboprop aircraft, Beach King Airs, Cheyenne, Piper Cheyennes, and I have flown 727. I have an airline transport license.
Wow.
I have flown those airplanes. I'm not typed in them. Mm-hmm. No reason to be. It takes a tremendous amount of money to get typed in an airplane like that. So, when I say type, I mean type certificate.
Yes.
So, but I've flown those airplanes.
Because you have to rack up a certain number of hours flying those aircraft.
Yeah. Well, that, and you have a check ride that you have to take, and it's just very expensive. So. There's no reason to have a type rating in an airplane if you're not going to fly that airplane.
Mm-hmm.
So,
do you still fly?
No, I haven't flown in years.
When did you stop?
Oh, I guess the last time I flew an airplane was back in '85.
Okay.
And I just haven't had any real desire. It's another one of those things that I like to do, but money enters into it, and mm-hmm. a lot of other things enter into it. I'm just not really that interested in flying. I would fly. You want to go fly?
Well, one of the reasons I'm asking questions about your flight experience, as I was reading your responses to the questionnaire, I was surprised that you did not pursue either OCS or warrant officer training so you could fly in the Army, as you enlisted for a three-year tour.
Right.
And so I guess this is an appropriate segue into Vietnam and what was going on in Southeast Asia. Of course, the Cold War was heating up throughout the 50s and early 60s. A couple of other important events that we haven't discussed yet, the Bay of Pigs invasion in Cuba, and then the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right. Remember them well.
Yeah. What do you recall of those events?
Well, of course, the Bay of Pigs happened under Kennedy's watch.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was really planned during Eisenhower's administration, if I'm not mistaken. And my impression, at least the stories that I've always gotten, is that Kennedy just failed to give the support. He just failed to follow through. And that's whether that's true or not. That's what I've always been told. What was the other?
What do you remember? Do you remember yourself anything specific about? How it was covered in the press here in Lubbock, or
no? I can't say that I do.
What your impressions at the time were?
No. The Avalanche Journal, and in those days, and to the degree that I don't know what it is today, but at that time the Avalanche Journal was a fairly conservative newspaper. Although I don't think they used that term. I don't think anybody. Conservative and liberal were a different terms than what they mean today, I suppose. But it was a conservative paper at that time, to the best of my memory. And I don't think that there was anything... I think it was more or less like factual reporting. I don't remember reading editorials, so I can't tell you what the actual feeling was. I think most people here felt like it was unfortunate that happened, but if it did happen, we had our chance at Castro, and we should have gotten it. I think that was the feeling that I remember, and I don't know whether I'm right or wrong, but that's just the way I remember it.
How about later in October 62 with the Cuban Missile Crisis?
I remember that pretty well. You know, I don't think it made a huge impression on me. I think the people that lived more proximate to the area had a much better feel for it. Again, West Texas, and you got to remember, we're talking 40 years ago, and essentially, and things have changed a lot since then. We just didn't have, those things did not have the impact, the immediacy that we feel for that sort of thing today because of things, outfits like CNN and that sort of, I guess.
But what about the television coverage of
coverage,
the crisis?
I don't remember a lot about it. I don't think I watched television a lot back in those days. I really don't even remember. I guess Huntley Brinkley? Were they on? I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't tell you.
Were there any particular programs, television programs that you watched as you grew up?
In the 60s?
Or 50s?
Or,
yeah.
Oh, I remember a lot of programs that that I enjoyed as a kid watching. Everybody remembers Gunsmoke.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. There was a whole series of westerns. You remember Have Gun, Will Travel, and my gosh, I'd forgotten about some of these. And Gunsmoke, of course, and what was the one that Steve McQueen was in? He did one for a while. All the usual things, you know, and I never was too much for, who was the blonde, I mean, the redheaded comedian, the girl, that woman, I Love Lucy, Lucille Ball,
yeah.
She was big back in those days. I didn't care that much. And, I don't know. I don't think I watched TV a lot. I think it was on a lot, but I don't think I watched it a lot. We got television late in our family. We didn't. They had several channels here before we ever even got a television set in the house, I think. So now I watch TV a lot. I'm getting to be old.
Well, at what point? But it was in 1965. You made the decision to enlist.
Yeah.
What did you know about what was happening in Southeast Asia before you enlisted? Do you remember?
I knew that if I enlisted or if I didn't enlist, I would probably go there. There was about a 90% chance that I would. My enlistment was kind of a trying to make the best of a bad situation. I had quit school, so I didn't have a student deferment, and I was working, so I was prime meat. And I remember you asked, well, why didn't you go for OCS or a warrant officer school? Why I didn't go for OCS, I can't give you a hard answer to that one.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to do the warrant officer, the Army warrant officer program for helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
But just for the record, so that because this tape can't show it, I'm wearing glasses that are probably a half inch thick, and they weren't any thinner back in those days.
Okay.
So my vision is what kept me out of flying for the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And I can add parenthetically right now that once you're in the Army, they don't care what your vision is, they'll take you. But by that time, you've got a longer commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And once you're in the Army, you don't want a longer commitment. Okay.
So, what is that?
So there were a couple. I had a couple of friends at the time that we were in pretty much the same situation. There were two or three of us, and we went down and discussed either whether to be just allow ourselves to be drafted, which I already had my draft notice, or whether we would join up and try to get the school or the whatever MOS that we wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I envisioned myself carrying a rifle through rice paddies, and I didn't think that was too desirable, so I enlisted in helicopter mechanic school, which gave me an extra year, but at least I was getting the school that I wanted to get, which, you know, being a pilot, being a mechanic is pretty useful. That didn't really worry me too much. I was young and stupid anyway. So I went ahead and enlisted. And then later, after I was in the Army, found out that I could go ahead. After I'd been in for about 6 months, I found out they would take me for the warrant officer program. But I would have been in about 4.5 to 5 years total time, as opposed to about 2.5 that I had to go at that time. So I thought, no, I'll pass on that. And I just never did. And that's the answer to that question. You know, it sounds real. I mean, it sounds simple right now, but you got a lot of things that you're trying to weigh as a kid. Mm-hmm. And I was 24. Got to remember, I enlisted in December of '65, so I was 24 years old. Mm-hmm. So I was a little older than the average. Most of them in bad days were 19, 20.
Do you remember when the Tonkin Gulf incidents occurred in '64?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. What do you recall?
That was '64, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you recall anything specific, or?
No, I just remember the alleged, quote, alleged incidents. I think I sense there have been a lot of, as to whether or not it was the Maddox and the Turner.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they were Turner Joy, mm-hmm. Yeah. Whether they were really being attacked or not, and I don't really know. The story that we heard here in West Texas was that the Maddox and the other Turner Joy had been attacked, and they had returned fire. Essentially, that's what it was. And then Johnson came in with his Tonkin Gulf resolution, mm-hmm. which Congress passed. And I guess that was the open door to the war.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't politically, like I said, I wasn't too politically oriented, but in '64, it was the first campaign, political campaign, that I did anything in. They always said, if you vote for Goldwater, you'll be in a war, and I did, and I was. So, you know, I guess that was the result of the Tonkin Gulf Resolution.
Mm-hmm. What did you think the United States was trying to accomplish? You know, at the time, as a young man, did you have any idea of what we were doing in Southeast Asia?
Well, I think the conventional view, mm-hmm. which was that we had treaty obligations with the Vietnamese. At least that's what I understood.
Mm-hmm.
I can't give you any documentation. I'll tell you what I understood. Mm-hmm. That we had treaty obligations with the Vietnamese and with other countries over there that we, number one, were upholding. Second, there was this domino theory that was very big at the time. And Vietnam was considered to be one of those dominoes, just like when it originated during the Korean War, I suppose. I suppose that's when that first started coming up. And I thought that, besides those two things, I thought that we probably were, the government, whether right or wrong, was trying to do the right thing with regard to the Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
I guess history will tell on that, but I think that was the impression that I had at the time, and kind of the general feeling. And then I knew I was going to go. Had about a 90% probability that I was going to go.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't know what it was all about. I mean, I really didn't.
Mm-hmm. Were you raised to think that participation was a patriotic duty?
Yeah. I was raised to that this is my country, and I have a responsibility to do what's expected of me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. at least up to a certain point. And if I were going to be drafted, well, I was going to do what I had to do, and so forth and so on. And I willingly signed the enlistment paper. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew what I was signing when I signed it. Mm-hmm. And it said, you're going to be a private in the United States Army. And I said, okay. I knew what I was signing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
What did your family think when you went and told them that you had enlisted or you were considering to enlist?
Well, it was understood that I was going to be drafted.
Okay.
So it was just a question of the additional year,
mm-hmm.
2 years as opposed to three. And I think that my father, he said to me one time that if he had known that I was thinking about enlisting, he probably would have gotten in touch with George Mahon, who was a congressman in mm-hmm. at that mm-hmm. time. And my dad knew George, and well, he knew some of these people around. And he said, I might very well have been able to get you into one of these, a commission of, or, you know, get you in where you could get a commission or mm-hmm. maybe into warrant school or something like that. And I said, well, you know, the damage is already done. He, I think, though, was pretty much glad that I went in. I mean, in the first place, he wasn't in World War II. He wasn't in the military in World War II because he had lost these two fingers, and also because he was in a what they called in those days a kind of a critical job. That is, certain agriculture and mm-hmm. that sort of thing. You had to have a certain number of farmers to produce the food and the fiber and all this other kind of stuff. He was married and had two small kids. I mean, or not 41. No, pardon me. He didn't. I was born in 41, so the war started in 41. So, but anyway, he had a deferment of some sort that he never went in the military, and he also had flat feet. But my dad was a very good physical specimen. I want to tell you, he was a strong man,
mm-hmm.
but he did have certain deficiencies. He had flat feet, and he had two missing fingers, and I think he had a plate. I know he had a plate, and so anyway.
Where?
Dental plate.
Okay.
And I don't know, all of these things conspired to keep him from being in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when I went in, I think secretly, he never said this exactly, although he did later on, that he was kind of glad that I went ahead and went in. Because
mm-hmm.
I had cousins that were in World War II, older cousins that were in World War II, much older cousins, by the way. And so I think he was kind of glad that I went in.
Did they ever talk about their World War II experiences with you?
No. My cousins?
Mm-hmm. Or any
no.
relatives?
Not really. I had one cousin that was in Europe during the war as a... he was a ball turret gunner on B-17s, if I'm not mistaken. Had another cousin that was in Europe as a... Signal Corps officer of some sort, more staff work. But he stayed in the Army for many years, retired from the Army. I had another cousin that was in the Adjutant General Corps during Korea, if I'm not mistaken. And so I had, had some cousins that were in the military. And most of these were on my mother's side, not on my father's side. And one cousin that's my age that went into the Air Force a little after I did. And he stayed, he was in 4 years, enlisted in the Air Force. So, there's not a strong tradition. I think just, it's a pretty much typical military service. And,
mm-hmm. When you were contemplating joining the Army, did you consider the other services, the Air Force, Marine Corps, Navy?
I considered the Marine Corps for about 30 seconds. yeah, I did. I don't know. The Army was that's just where I seemed to be wanted to be. And I wanted to be in helicopters. Somehow or other, I wanted to have something to do with flying and to be helicopters appeal to me, and I'm not mechanically inclined as a, you know, I'm not a mechanic, but somehow or other that kind of appealed to me, and I thought, well, and I can learn something there. I can learn to be an aircraft mechanic, because I know, I mean, factually at that time, you could come out of the Army with that, with a mechanics, with being a mechanic in the Army, and the FAA made certain accommodations to get your aircraft and power plant mechanic license. And I thought, well, as pilot, that will be very valuable to me if I have an A&P also. You know, it just kind of makes you like a triple threat type. And I thought, well, that'll be good. So, I picked the Army deliberately. I didn't give too much consideration to the Air Force because I think the enlistment was 4 years. And I considered the Marines, and I dropped them real quick, and because I had a friend that had two friends that had gone in the Marines, and they knew the one liked it. And the Navy never really appealed to me. I had a cousin that was in the Navy for quite a period of time. He's a good man. Didn't ruin him.
Okay. Well, all right, you enlisted, you left, went to basic training. Why don't you go ahead and describe leaving and where you went for your initial training?
Well, let's see. Went to basic training at Fort Polk, Louisiana in the winter, which, believe me, is the time to go through basic training in Louisiana. It's wet, but at least it's not hot. And right at the end of basic training, I got... I damaged my, was it right or left foot? Right foot. Split the nail on the big toe right down the middle. It was like that, and it swelled up about that big. And I got, after we all, after graduation from basic training, well, I got held over there for a few weeks. Then I went to Fort Rucker, Alabama, for helicopter, for mechanic school. Actually, two mechanic school. One of them is basically a toolbox holder. You kind of learn, you know, this is a wrench, you know, this is a big hammer, don't use hammers on airplanes, you know, that sort of thing. And then the next one was they call it single engine, single rotor, turbine helicopter mechanic. And our crew chief school. Okay. And there they teach you a little bit more in depth. A lot of some of the stuff I already knew, having been around airplanes for a long period of time. But it was actually not a bad school. And then I got out of there, and was sent to Vietnam.
Did you know that was going to happen? Or?
Yeah, you know you're going. It, you know, it becomes more and more obvious every day on a day-to-day basis. You know you're going.
What was the hardest thing about basic training other than injuring yourself?
Well, that was an accident. That if I had kicked something, it wouldn't have happened. Anyway, and I don't remember what it was, but I split that nail. I'm not a competitive person. I mean, I say that. Sports don't mean a lot to me. When I grew up, I didn't play baseball. I didn't play football, except what I had to. You know, you play a little football in college, or I mean, in high school, and things like that. You know, but I'm not a competitive, sports-oriented type person, and I'm not a driven type person from a sports standpoint. It's not that I don't have an appreciation of it. It just isn't something that I have ever liked. So basic training for me was pretty hard. I didn't really know how to throw a ball very well, so that makes throwing a grenade difficult. Although in shooting, I did real well because I grew up shooting a rifle out here in West Texas, and you know, a rifle's a rifle's a rifle. The military discipline end of it, that's just a matter of attitude. But I was not physically, I just wasn't a, I'm not a great physical specimen. I never have been, you know. I had a little trouble in basic training just with the physicality of it, you know, doing the physical things, the running and the jumping and all that kind of stuff. Although I was pretty good at doing low crawl in the mud. I could do that pretty well. Anyway, that was probably the hardest part of it, was the physical part of it. And I got through it. You know, when you get through it, you do the things that you have to do. And then later on, I mean, and you learn to run. You know how it is.
You mentioned a lot of rifle experience before going in the Army. I take it you hunted quite a bit.
We used to hunt. And I mean, I'm not a great hunter, don't misunderstand. But out in this part of the country, well, you learn to hunt.
Mm-hmm. What did you hunt?
Oh, small game. Bird shooting and rabbits and that sort of thing. And I've hunted deer and things like that.
How about javelina?
Never have shot javelina. Never have. I had the opportunity a couple of times. In fact, I got down in the woods one time down in South Texas in the mesquite brush down in that part of the country and heard some javelinas going like that, and I thought, I'm getting out of here. Because I wasn't sure that I would see them in time, so I left. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay. In basic training, any blanket parties, shower parties, anything like that?
You know, you always hear about those things, but the answer is no. I don't know of any of that. I never, it just didn't happen. Not in my unit. How long is basic training? Is it 12 or 16 weeks? I've forgotten which. 12 weeks, I think. Or maybe it's only 8 or 9.
It varied, but it was about between 12 and 16.
And in that time frame, we actually, from what I remember, basic training was, we had a pretty good group, pretty good basic training company. Mm-hmm. I just don't recall any of that, no. Mm-hmm. There were some people, I think, that had a great deal of difficulty adapting and that sort of thing. And I'm not saying I didn't have my share of it just because of the physical training. Yeah. But no. I can't tell you that it did.
What was the harshest form of discipline you witnessed in basic training?
Witnessed or experienced? I guess really they're
both.
One and the same.
Well, you could have witnessed a trainee taken behind a building. And
no, I know it. I know what you're getting at. No, and I never saw anything like that. I really didn't. I never saw any physical discipline. No, I never saw a sergeant grab a kid out. Taken behind them, and the kid comes out, you know, black and blue. Now, I never saw anything like that. In fact, really, I think that our drill sergeants were pretty good. I mean, considering what they're working with and what their level of experience is and their training and so, I didn't have any complaint in that regard. I may have at the time, but I'm talking about it in retrospect. I became a low crawl expert because I wasn't physically prepared to do a lot of these things. I got that way real quick. I came out a whole lot better than what I went in, but I think that was the worst punishment was making the whole platoon stand out there while I went through the low crawl about four or five times, you know, because I didn't get through the run and dodge and jump or whatever it was in the requisite amount of time or whatever it was. Now, I don't remember too much in the way of punishment. They weren't. There was enough incentive, you know, to get you mentally up to go through. I just don't remember that.
Were there many invocations of Vietnam? This is you pay attention. This will save your life in Vietnam. That type of thing.
Yeah, there was. There was basic training. There was a lot of that, and in any other school that you went through, you always heard that. You need to know this because, and that was very common. But you got to remember, basic training was in 66, December, starting in the last couple of days in December 65. Mm-hmm. Vietnam was still new. There were not an awful lot of people who had already been there. Mm-hmm. So the cadre that had already been there were really very few. Out of, a cadre of, say, 8 or 9 instructors in mechanic school, maybe one or two of them had some limited experience. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, there were things were already filtering down. These are things that you need to know. Mm-hmm. And in basic training, it was kind of the same way. There were not an awful lot of people that had already been there. Mm-hmm. So they didn't have a lot of information to impart. But some of these people in 65 were still there, held over from making a career of the Army, and they had been in Korea. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not the same place, but these were combat veterans. Some of them were. And some of them were very good at imparting their skills to you. These are things that you need to know. And in some cases they weren't. You know, there were a lot of guys that were just there doing, pulling their time and as little of it as they could, and they were gone. So I think it's a mix, but just remember that Vietnam was relatively new, and then people had filtered back through the system to come back in and teach.
Were there many references to the Vietnamese themselves in terms of, calling them the Viet Cong, or how did they refer to the Vietnamese enemy?
You know, I really don't. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't remember. I think you heard the whole string of varied names. The Viet Cong were all. You didn't hear the word, the two words Viet Cong very much. You'd hear VC, mm-hmm. Charlie, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. Indigenous personnel were referred to. You'd hear all kinds of names, but nothing that stands out. No, I can't say that.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. I'm just trying to think. I really can't say that.
And the instructors that did have Vietnam experience, do you recall any particular lessons that they tried to invoke based on their Vietnam experience? Is there anything that sticks out in your mind even to this day?
Well, I kind of remember one drill sergeant that had been to Vietnam. I think he had been in some kind of an advisory group or something, and that's about all they had up until 65 or so. Mm-hmm. And he very frequently would say, now this is the way we do it here, but that's not the way it's really done. And then he would say, you know, you don't want to step in that hole, you know, because there might be a punchy stake in that hole or something. You know, I kind of remember that sort of thing from this guy. For instance, you might be on a range or something, and you were supposed to run and jump in the hole and fire your rifle, just as an example. Mm-hmm. And he would say, now that's the way we do it here. He says, you're not going to do that over there. You know. He would tell you why. Mm-hmm. You know. He said, there could be a tripwire. He said, very typically, if it's an inviting hole, it's got a tripwire on it. Mm-hmm. You know, and there are a lot of things, and he would, of course, these were small things, and they were things that I guess in the moment made an impression on you, but I don't know whether you remember them later on. I don't know. In mechanic school, in crew chief school, you learned a lot of, you learned all of the basic things that the Army wanted you to know about how your aircraft worked and what you needed to do, how you replaced this black box and what you did with that piece of machinery and so forth and so on, a transmission, whatever the case might be. But there were also some instructors that taught you the shortcuts. This is the quick and this is the down and dirty way to get this thing back in operation. Things like that. In other words, one of the lessons that I remember was packing what's called a short shaft, which is the shaft that connects the engine to the transmission on a helicopter. And it's a shaft that is a flexible shaft. It's turning at a very high RPM, and it's got constant velocity joints on both end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's sitting, it's mounted in the helicopter like this, but this is turning at this speed.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to, it's constantly in a mesh situation. Well, it has to be taken apart periodically and repacked, put back together.
Packed with grease.
Grease. And there is the correct way to do it, and then there's the down and dirty way to get it, the aircraft flying in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
And little things like that, that you would learn. These were things that you would do in the field, and then when you had the time, you'd pull it out and do it correctly. But you had to get, if you had to get the aircraft flying, things of that nature. That's just one of the things that comes to mind immediately. But it was, you know. So yeah, there was some of that. Yes.
How about the use of 100 mile an hour tape?
Duct tape was not real common back in those days. Mm-hmm. To tell you the truth,
mm-hmm.
not really duct tape. It just didn't see it very much.
Okay.
And I learned how to patch using I learned the old way of learning how to patch aluminum.
Hmm.
To rivet on a patch and things like that. Yeah, I learned those, and I already knew some of that before I went in because I had done a little bit of it on airplanes out in the field.
Okay.
Just as a matter of practical experience, I knew how to do that. But yeah, that's I've heard it 100 mile an hour tape. Wasn't used not that I know of. I heard rumors that you could put duct tape as long as you counterweighted it properly, put the same amount of tape on both blades, that you could do it on a helicopter. But I've never seen it done. I have no knowledge of it, but I've heard that you could.
All right, Kim. Do you have any questions you'd like to ask at this point?
What kind of helicopters were you trained on as a mechanic?
Well, would you like me just to walk you through what I remember of mechanic school?
Sure.
Okay. First school, as I said, was kind of a toolbox carrier school, you know, and literally this is a ranch. I mean, because some people come in not knowing anything.
Okay.
The next school, and that's very simple. The next school is a little bit more complicated, where they actually teach you a great, and I thought very effectively in a short period of time, teach you about what it takes to maintain an aircraft, and secondly, some specifics in the way of maintenance, and then relating it directly to particular aircraft. So that was sort of a building block process. I knew quite a bit about general aircraft maintenance because as a pilot, you kind of become familiar with some of these things. And if you want to, you can usually go out to a shop someplace and walk around and learn a lot, which I did. I had always kind of, I'm not a mechanic, but I kind of wanted to know about some things. The more specific thing about aircraft maintenance itself, they would teach you things like how to adjust the valves on a reciprocating engine, which were going out at that time, but the Army still had them, or how to time the magnetos on an aircraft engine. Those seem like outdated things, but in those days, the Army still had aircraft that had those things on them. And in fact, we had some aircraft that had exactly that sort of thing in Vietnam. Then the aircraft that you were most interested in learning about was the UH-1, the Huey, what everybody calls the Huey, which is not really the Huey, it's the Iroquois. And the UH-1 aircraft was fairly new to the inventory at that time. It was just beginning to come into the human inventory as a common item, and it was unique in the sense that it was among the first of the military aircraft to have turbine power engines, or had turbine engines. They didn't teach you a lot about the engines, but they taught you a lot about what to look for trouble in the engines, and how to maintain them. They weren't interested in you being able to take the darn thing apart and put it back together. But they were interested in you know being able to recognize what the problem areas might be. Okay, and things like being able to recognize problem areas in the transmission. If you're familiar with helicopters, the engine drives the transmission. The transmission is what turns the rotor blades. So you needed to be able to understand transmissions. Helicopters are very, very mechanical devices. They do not fly naturally. You know, airplane pilots can become, they're kind of complacent guys. They're easygoing and happy-go-lucky, but helicopter pilots they're a nervous breed. You know what I mean? Because they know that something is going to happen. It's just a question of when. So you kind of had to develop a feel for, you needed to know what the problem areas were. And I think they were more interested in saying, this is the way this thing works. This is what it is, hands-on. Okay, now this is what can go wrong, and this is what you need to look for. And in the meantime, we'll teach you how to adjust the pitch change links to track the rotor blades and things of that nature. So you learned some very practical things that you needed to do to get vibrations out and all that kind of stuff, and be able to change a radio out and move the battery from one place to the next place and all that kind of stuff. But which sounds simple, but it's not really. And you also learned a lot about what to look for, so that you could then go to somebody in maintenance and say, I've got a problem with my aircraft. Do you know what? Does that make sense? The aircraft that we, specific to your question, the aircraft that I learned the most about was the UH-1, which is good because that's what I was on. I also learned a lot about H-13s, which were an older type airplane, a Bell airplane, a Bell helicopter, a Bell helicopter that was reciprocating engine driven. I learned a lot about those. And to a lesser degree about some of the, of much lesser degree about some of the Army's big helicopters, like at that time the CH-37 Cheyenne, which was a monster. It was just, you know, no, don't ask me even how it flew. And then later on the CH-47, the Chinook. And there were a lot of derivatives of these aircraft. But specific to my training, it was single engine, single rotor, turbine powered helicopter. And there was only one. That was a Huey.
Did you ever have any of the company's representatives come out and train or give specific lectures? Or?
No, not that I recall. I don't have any of that. But there was, I do remember this, there were Bell representatives. Bell was the builder of the helicopter. There were, I believe it was Bell. Huey's a Bell. And yeah. Gosh, time flies. There were Bell people on at Fort Rucker all the time. But you got to remember, Fort Rucker was the Army's pilot training base also. Fort Walters for a primary, and then they took the advanced training at Fort Rucker. And so there would have been naturally. Did we have any interaction with those people? No. I don't ever recall meeting. I remember seeing Bell stuff, trailers marked Bell, and also Boeing Vertol, which is makes the CH-47, and stuff like that. But I remember seeing those, you know, like trailers and people with cars and stuff that had those. But we didn't have any interaction with them. You got to remember, I was way down. I was at the bottom of the pile, looking up, and those guys were way up here at the top of the pile.
Did you see any Bell field representatives in Vietnam?
I may have, but I don't have any. I may have, but I don't recall it. We had some civilians that came through the troop a couple of times, having something to do with helicopters. But I don't recall specifically. Nice to have met you.
So you, let's see, you found out you're going to Vietnam. You must have, was it something that your parents talked with you about?
No, I think everybody just, this was the way it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
No, we didn't have any. I don't think we had any specific conversations about that. No. Had specific conversations about that with my girlfriend. But,
okay.
No, with my parents, no. I think it was just I think everybody just kind of understood that's the way it was going to be.
Now, this is the girlfriend that became your fiance in Germany.
Yeah, she
that you who you visited.
She and I, we got to know each other here at Tech, and she's extremely intelligent, very good person.
Mm-hmm.
And the long and the short of it is that. We were engaged, but she knew I was, you know, the military was something I was going to have to get out of the way before we were going to get married or anything else. I mean, it was just the one that you just had to do that. I mean, we couldn't see any future with me being in the Army and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and she was more interested in staying in school, so she stayed in school, and I went in the Army, and she. She knew that I was going to Vietnam. We talked about it quite a bit. And probably I talked to her more about it than a whole lot more with her than I did with my mother and dad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you recall what you talked about?
What we talked about?
Yeah.
No. Not specifically. I can't tell you that I do, Steve. I really can't.
And... why don't you go ahead then describe what it was like leaving the United States and arriving in Vietnam?
Real strange and kind of scary. When I got out of school in at Fort Rucker, I was given leave again. I'd had leave out of basic training before I went to Fort Rucker, and then. Was given leave, and I had orders to report to, and I think I was probably about 2 or 3 weeks leave, something like that. And then I went to, I was told to report to the Oakland Army Base, I believe they called it at the time, I'm not sure, which was the outgoing processing center. I went through Los Angeles, flew up to Oakland, and caught the bus out to the, they had buses and everything, you know, it was all pretty well organized,
mm-hmm.
out to the, to Oakland. They did some processing there. They took away all of your gear, left you with a uniform and a couple of changes of underwear and odds and ends like that, you know. And they didn't issue you anything, really. Went to and hung around there. I mean, literally hung around there for probably 24 to 36 hours in that range. And they had all the enlisted people in one big building, big hangar type building, and they had all the officers over in another building, and identical, looked just like just the same. And kept us there for, like I said, 24 to 36 hours, put us on a bus and took us over to, I've forgotten what Air Force Base it is, right there close to Oakland, and shipped us out. It was a charter flight. I believe it was a Pan American charter flight. We flew from from San Francisco to Anchorage to someplace in Japan. We had a little layover in both places for refueling type layovers, and the one in Japan was a little longer than that. It was a few hours. I think something was wrong with the aircraft, something like that. And then we got back on the aircraft and had a very, very scary flight for me because I'm being a pilot. I knew a little bit about what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
A very scary flight from Tokyo, or Yokota Air Force Base, mm-hmm. I think, isn't that Yokota? Down to Tonsonut. And that was a scary flight for me because it was had a lot of weather, and it was really bad thunderstorm type weather. And that was a very scary, just a physically a scary. I'm not a good passenger. got off the plane at Tansanute, and I've told this story 1,000 times, but I'll tell it to you. Got off the airplane, I had to go to the bathroom so bad I could hardly stand it. I mean, I needed to take a leak. It was terrible. And believe it or not, they made us go through Vietnamese customs. You actually had to go through customs. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're going to go fight a war in your country, and they're having you go through customs. Anyway, everybody's standing in line. We go through customs. I've got to go to the bathroom. Bad. Somebody said, that's it over there. So I went in there, and here is this fairly large room, probably this size room. And there's a gray slate wall here and a gray slate wall over there. Mama-san is hunkered down over here. Mama-san's hunkered down over there. And you're supposed to pee against that gray slate wall, or there are holes in the floor. Asian-type toilets, which I became quite used to. And I just thought, well, here I am from West Texas. I think I'll just wait a year. But it didn't work quite that way. You got more used to it as time went by.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that was the introduction. They then ran us out to buses. I say ran us out. You know, they herd everybody out to these big buses. And they were school bus type affairs, a painted OD, mm-hmm. with a heavy screen, very heavy screens over the wrapped around all of the windows in the bus, and sandbags on the floor. And they were, I guess they were serious about it, because, and they had armed guard on the bus, saying, you know, it has happened. We don't think it'll happen, but it has been known to happen that a grenade gets thrown at the bus. So, and they took us in convoys of buses out to Long Bend Junction, that's our LBJ, mm-hmm. which was the replacement depot, which is a terrible, terrible, terrible place. And food was bad, latrines were bad, sleeping was bad. It was a terrible, terrible, terrible place. Officers and EM all running around not knowing what was going on. And they'd have formations of officers over here, EM over there, and call out names and all this other kind of stuff. And that's the first time that I stood guard duty in Vietnam, though, was at LBJ. If you volunteered for guard duty, you didn't have to do anything else. So I did guard duty at night. And I think we were there 2 nights. Got there one evening, was there the whole day, if I'm not mistaken. That night, the next morning, we shipped out. And they ran us again, the bus routine, ran us back to Tansanute or someplace. Took a C-130 up to, I want to say Cam Ranh Bay, I'm not sure. It's kind of vague. And from Cam Ranh Bay, we flew in a Caribou up to An K. At that point, we knew we were going to the first cab. Okay, everybody in this bunch was going to the first cab. So then we got off the plane at off of Caribou at An K. Really hadn't had a change in uniform or anything else for, I'd say this was like the fourth or fifth day now going on. At least the fourth day. And got off the airplane at An K. They herd everybody into tents, and we all kind of waited. There was this kind of a long waiting process. It seems in retrospect like a long time. And I remember that I've talked to a couple of friends that were there with me at the time, and we all remember this real well. This specialist, I think he was a Spec 4, maybe Spec 5, came out and says, well, I'm going to get the bad news over with first. He said, the following people are going to the 1st Squadron of the 9th Cav. Well, we didn't know it. Had no idea. That didn't mean anything to me. You know, you could hear people going, oh, my God, you know, and all this. They started calling off names and called off my name. As you called off your name, you're supposed to go outside and form up in formation. And from the little airfield, we went inside the what was called, I think it was called Fort Camp Radcliffe, I believe An K, the first Cav's camp there at An K was called Camp Radcliffe. That's from memory. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Went in there, and they started dropping people off at the various sites, wherever, you know, if you were in this unit, you go to that site, and so forth and so on. and dropped several of us off at the 9th, 1st Squadron of the 9th Cav. And I was now at my unit.
Mm-hmm.
And how I got assigned to that unit, I have no idea. I don't understand the... I don't know the dynamics of it. I don't know how this, what the selection process was or anything else. I'm assuming it was strictly random. And got there. And I really can't tell you too much about it. It was on the side of a hill. It was the headquarters of the squadron, but the squadron itself was out in the field. All four troops of the squadron at that time were out in the field. They were always out in the field. They were never at where the cav was located.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a headquarters cadre that was there. There was a first sergeant or sergeant major who was overall in charge, and there were some supply sergeants and various clerks and all this other kind of stuff. And they line us up and said, okay, you're going to A troop, you're going to B troop, you're going to C troop, and so forth and so on, you know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sent over to supply. They issued us things like weapons and this is like the middle of, earlier to the middle part of the afternoon. And if memory serves, and they issued weapons, jungle fatigues and assorted, you know, personal items to you. Flight helmets to those of us that were crew members. The usual things that you were supposed to get. And not all of it, because some of it was in short supply. I remember a few things. Anyway, and then we were on our own. And they mentioned something about, well, you'll be here for a while because you've got to do some in-country training. Well, a friend of mine and I, a fellow named Gil Willett, he is from Massachusetts. We walked down to the flight line. We'd always heard of the golf course. The golf course in Vietnam was... Have you ever heard the term golf course? The golf course at Camp Radcliffe was where all of the helicopter landing pads were.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called a golf course because it sort of looked like greens, you know, and with putting greens, mm-hmm. you know, and fairways and stuff. So we walked down there, and we were both just amazed because you could open... Here's this great big huge open field, great big huge thing. All these landing helicopter pads and everything else, and you could walk up to a Connex or a little bunker and open up the door, and you could. There was all kinds of ammunition and grenades and all this other kind of stuff, and we were just, what? You know, in training, all of this stuff is issued to you one at a time, you know, like this, and what you didn't use, you gave back by counting it out back to them, and here were thousands of rounds of ammunition and rockets and grenades and. You know, and you could pick them up and handle them and do anything you wanted to with them,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so we loaded up. Anyway, and literally, we did. I remember that. And went back. The next morning, they said, well, we're not going to have any time for training. You're going to go back out to the field. You're not going to go back. You're going out to the field. So that afternoon, middle of the afternoon, helicopter came in. From B Troop, and there were probably three or maybe four of us that were new crew chiefs, and we all jumped on the aircraft and went out in the field. Now that was the first time that I'd ever been on a helicopter, ever. My first helicopter flight. And the next morning, I crewed a helicopter into combat.
Well, you never received a test flight or a sample flight in training?
Never been on a helicopter. And the next morning I went out, counted the rotor blades, divided by two, and it all came out even. and got on the aircraft, and we went down.
Now, was that a field rep training technique? Or? A couple of questions about stepping back. You mentioned getting processed through Oakland.
Yeah.
And doing whatever... processing the Army needed to do before leaving. Did any of that include getting your personal affairs in order?
You know, yes, it did.
Wills, power of attorneys, and things like that.
Yeah, it did. It was all just formalities to me
mm-hmm.
because I didn't have anything. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it had to do with... they had a lot of things like that. Making sure you had the insurance that you wanted to get
mm-hmm.
that was, you know, whatever was available to you. Make sure you had the opportunity to get that. Making sure that you're I think there was a There was a power of attorney that you signed for somebody back home to be able to take care of. There was I don't remember at all what all it was. Mm. But yes. Yeah. There were also things like medical records that were checked and personnel records that were checked and a whole bunch of other stuff. It was a processing that you went through. And I think some people were getting shots. I didn't get any shots, but there were some people that were getting shots. Mm. And because they had a shot line. You remember with those guns?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was a lot of that going on. There was the stuff about your personal affairs. I remember there was do you own a car? That was one of the questions. Do you own a car? Yes or no? Where is it? Do you have a title to it? Things of like that. You know, yeah, there was a lot of that stuff going on. Yeah, exactly. But you got by that time, you know, you had been through coming into the Army. You went through that. You went through basic training. There was an awful lot of that. And you go through, you know, and every now and then you get marched through a line, so you don't think too much about it. So, yes, the answer to your question in short is yes. Yeah.
It didn't feel a little bit different in that, I mean, here you are, I mean, basically doing what you need to do in the event that you die.
In the event that you die, yes. I think that is in the back of, I started to say in the back of your mind. It's probably right up there in the front of your mind, yes. But I don't think, you know, I don't think people were making a big deal out of it because you're young and you're immortal. And it's, the real impact of it doesn't hit you. Yeah.
What did you discuss with the fellow soldiers you sat with on the plane, your passengers, on the flights over?
On the flight over, believe it or not, I was sitting right next to, I think it was a major. I think this guy was a major.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he was real interested in talking.
Okay.
I think I said sir to him a few times.
Mm.
I don't mean by that he was unfriendly.
No.
I didn't have anything. I had no commonality with him. I didn't know him. He was substantially out of my pay grade. And I just didn't have anything to say to him. I think he was pleasant to me and I was pleasant to him, but mm-hmm. I don't recall any.
Okay.
And you know, I tried to sleep as much as possible, which is kind of my technique on an airplane anyway. Be quiet and still and sleep. Just the way I do that. I don't remember too much about that. I remember the flight from Japan down to Tansanudas being a real white knuckle flight for me because, I mean, the weather was awful,
mm-hmm.
And then we made a very very steep approach into Tansanud. I mean, it was he pulled the power back and it was a real interesting. It was 707 and it was the tightest approach I've ever seen in my life. I've made some tight approaches. He brought the airplane in from high altitude. It was interesting. I remember that flight quite well. Really did.
And he did that for?
I am assuming he did it for so as not to get shot at. I don't know that. I have no knowledge of that. Again, that was in September of '66, and I don't know whether. I don't know what the air warfare potentiality of the Vietnamese were at that time. I don't have any idea, but I do remember that it was a very steep approach. It was a high overhead circling type approach. And I mean, he pulled the power off, and we made about three or four turns around like this coming down. I mean, I watched. You could see the same point on the ground all the time. So it was very interesting. He made about three or four turns like this, came out. Made a base leg and landed. I mean, it was real quick.
Okay. So when you arrived to Beechu,
yeah.
First of the night,
right?
And actually, from the let me go back. From the time you arrived in Vietnam to the time you arrived at Beechu, and as you described it, you went on a helicopter ride one day and recruit shipping the next. What kind of briefings did you receive about? You know, what you should or shouldn't do in Vietnam, interacting with the Vietnamese people, That kind of stuff.
None. That's always been interesting. That's a very interesting question, Steve. And the answer that I give you is essentially none. We talked earlier about basic training. What did you learn that would apply to Vietnam? Same thing in mechanic school. But in as far as interacting with the Vietnamese people or having anything to do with them or what to do socially or non-socially, etc., none. I don't recall any training in that regard. No briefings, or anything of that nature. I have no memory of it whatsoever.
How about booklets or, you know, pamphlets or something, you know, outlining Vietnamese customs and things of that nature?
There may have been some. I don't remember them. I don't have any copies of them. Nothing that I can tell you about that. I just don't remember anything like that. And so my answer has to be, I don't think I ever saw anything.
And were you ever given any instructions on things that you weren't allowed to do, like prostitutes, things of that nature?
Well, there were the usual cautions that the Army, you know, you get the usual... the old training film syndrome, but you know, I never saw any of those. What people laugh at about those old training films, I never saw any of those that I recall. I'm sure, I probably did. They probably just went in here and out there.
Mm-hmm.
But not much in the way of orientation in that direction at all.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing about don't deal with the whores or don't do this or don't do that. There were some word of mouth things that came down, things that you should not do, but it came down more or less word of mouth. People would say, well, I've been told that, which is hearsay.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't recall any information with regard to dealing with the Vietnamese people on any level.
Mm-hmm.
And in truth, the entire year that I was there, I had very little dealings directly with Vietnamese people, or mountain yards for that matter. And I found the mountain yards to be a lot better people than the Vietnamese, myself.
Did you eventually work at all with ARVN units?
Yeah.
South Vietnamese military units?
A few times. And I didn't find them to be particularly well-trained or trustworthy. Now, I may have gotten some of my feelings about that from other people.
Mm-hmm.
I may have sort of picked that up, some of that, by osmosis. But I know this. A few times we would carry them into landing zones and stuff like that. You practically had to kick them off the aircraft.
Why?
Because they weren't going to get off.
Okay.
I know factually, I know for an absolute fact that one crew chief on one of my sister aircraft, same unit, pulled a gun on a Vietnamese lieutenant and forced him off the aircraft, and that's the only way they can get that aircraft unloaded. I know that for an absolute fact. And that's the only way they got those people off that aircraft. He literally had to pull his pistol out, point it at that Vietnamese head, and said, "Get your ass off this aircraft." And that's the way they got the aircraft unloaded.
Because
he wasn't going to go otherwise.
With these
and knowing this guy, he probably would have shot him too.
Mm-hmm. Were these hot LZs?
No. If they had been hot, he wouldn't have been on there that long.
Mm-hmm. Did you as a crew chief ever fly Vietnamese into a hot LZ? Vietnamese units?
Well, you know, hot LZs come in a lot of different... hot LZ is sort of what you want to make out of it. I think we probably flew some Vietnamese into LZs where we were drawing fire, but very minimally, very, very minimally, maybe some very light small arms fire. But into one where you had something like 12-7 shooting at you or something like that, no, nothing, no. In fact, one of the things about B Troop is we did not have a lot of interaction with the Arvin at all. We did, the most that I remember interacting directly with the Arvin was out to the west and southwest of Pleiku, in the area around what we call Plantation, which is, have you ever heard that term, Plantation, out west of Pleiku? Oh, okay. And also down near Pleini, which is not too far from the Chupang Massif, where the big famous the Battle of the Ai Drang was. That seems to me to be, if memory serves, where we had the most interaction with the Arvin, and that wasn't a lot. It seems to me like we had we went in and picked up maybe a platoon or a little more than a platoon of Arvin. At the most, a half dozen times. And I would say that was probably my limited experience with it. And that, and one of those would have been the time that, that the lieutenant, that lieutenant with his squad refused to get off the aircraft. And that was not on my aircraft. So that was another aircraft. And I heard about that from three separate sources. I know that that happened. There is no question in my mind. So, but I didn't have a great deal of respect for the Arvin, and if I had been on the ground, I wouldn't have, I would not have been counting on them to give me much help. Mm-hmm. And I was on the ground a few times. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, what kind of, what model of Hueys did you have at the first of the at the B Troop first of the ninth when you arrived?
When I got there, as far as Hueys go, we had B model gunships. Those gunships were equipped with either flex-mounted M60 machine guns, quad-mounted, or rockets, or M5 40-millimeter grenade launchers, or a combination of them. In addition to that, they carried a gunner and a crew chief as a gunner, so a crew of four and weapons. And the gunner and crew chief also usually carried a couple of cases of grenades, or at least a case of grenades. Very useful, and especially for some smoke grenades and Willy Pete and stuff like that, for the purpose of marking targets and also for taking out some light targets and stuff. Those were the gunships. We had Delta model Hueys, the longer the extension, the extended model, for the lift ships. And later on, the gunships, the Bravo models, were slowly exchanged out for Charlie models, which was a big improvement. And the Delta models, the D models, were changed out for H models. And the only real difference in the D and the H model was the engine, which was went from the Dash 11 to the Dash 13 engine. And that helped quite a bit because there's a lot more torque. So, and I started off. I started off in lift, which was the Deltas. But I flew at right immediately thereafter. Then I went over to gunships, and I spent some time in gunships as a crew chief there. And then I went back to lift, and I spent the vast majority of my time in there. I also spent a little bit of time trying to learn to be an observer on H-13s. We had these little bubble model Hueys, bubble model Bells, and they would, I'd be flying as an observer on a mission and those things, and they'd say, see those guys down there? No. You see that bunker over there? No. You know, I didn't see things. I didn't have the knack for being able to spot from the air what was obvious to other people, I guess. and it I just wasn't very good at it. As a gunner, as a in gunships, that's okay. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any trouble there. But my natural place seemed to have been over in the lift aircraft. That's where I gravitated, and they kind of let you, they, meaning the commanders of the various sections, the gunships, the lift ships, the scouts, they kind of let you gravitate to where you were best place was. It wasn't at all unusual for a crew chief to move from one place to another place if there was an opening, until he sort of found out, well, this is really where I'm best suited.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, if they needed you someplace, they were going to put you there. Don't misunderstand. But I kind of gravitated to the lift aircraft, and there were other guys that kind of gravitated to the red ships. And so I think it worked that way pretty well.
Now, so the first mission that you went out on, this would have been in mid-'68?
Would have been September.
September of
68?
67.
Or 67. Pardon me, September of 66. September of 66.
That's right. September.
I got there first part of September of 66.
Okay. You went on your first ride, went on your first mission next day. This was, why don't you go ahead and describe that mission?
Well,
what was involved, and where did your ship fit into that mission?
You kind of have to go back to the evening before that, when we had just gotten there.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to see, I reported to the first sergeant, all of us reported to the first sergeant. And he didn't really have time for us. And he said, Hobbs, you go to go see Captain Higginbotham. Well, I didn't know who Captain Higginbotham was, but he was the man in charge of lift aircraft. And
mm-hmm.
he said, and Higginbotham said, you know how to crew an aircraft? And I said, well, I've been to school. And this is all in military parlance. And he said, well, you crew my aircraft tomorrow. Okay, that's fine with me, sir. Anything you want, sir. And he said, we'll be inserting blues around 6 o'clock in the morning, so we'll have the aircraft ready to go, whatever it was, 5:30, whatever. I don't know. It was early, sunrise type thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I went over. I made up my bed for the evening in a pup tent. I slept in a pup tent a lot those days.
Mm-hmm.
And next morning I was up. Didn't have any breakfast, I remember, or at least I don't think I did. And went out to the aircraft, and I really had no idea what to do. I had ridden on a helicopter one time in my life, and
mm-hmm.
that was as a passenger in the back. And that was it. And I had been school on helicopters, but that was it. So I literally, as a joke myself, I said, well, it's got 4 rotor blades. There's 2 in front, 2 on top, and 2 in the back, and that's 4 divided by 2 is 2. And it works all right. So, you know, and I was making a little joke about it, but I knew where to check the oil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I checked the oil, and I did the things that I knew how to open up and look around. And after a while, they came out and said, is the aircraft ready to go? And I said, yes, sir, I guess it is. So the pilots always did a walk around, and he did, and I walked around with him, and I said, you know, if anything you can teach me, I'd sure appreciate it. And he says, well, is this airplane ready to fly? Yes, sir. Or aircraft, is this helicopter ready to fly? Yes, sir, as far as I know. So about that time, the infantry came out. We had our own integral. See, I didn't know anything about what, I had no idea what this was about.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what we were going to, I didn't even know what this was. But the troop had its own integral infantry platoon, and they came out and they had their own aircraft. They flew on the same squad, flew on the same aircraft most of the time, so mm-hmm. forth and so on. Well, he was the leader. He was 3-5, and so the platoon for 3-5, the squad for 3-5 came out, loaded on board the aircraft, and I'm standing out there, you know, and they crank up the aircraft and everything, and the airplane's running. And he motions me to get on, and we get on, and we take off and go. And Steve, it's strange. I mean, you think this doesn't happen, but that's the story.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we went out. We flew probably I don't know how long. I don't remember exactly how long. I'm going to say 20 minutes. And the other aircraft are joined up on us in a echelon formation, and they're all pretty close. And I'm kind of nervous about this because helicopters, you don't want those rotor blades to touch.
Mm-hmm.
And I really was kind of nervous, and I had no idea what was going on. And I'm listening. I'm wearing this big white flight helmet, you know, and I'm listening to all that's going on, you know, and I can turn this
here and all this other stuff. I'm finding out about these things. It's touchy-feely. Mm-hmm. And I'm wearing my 45, you know, I was real impressed. And they went into trail formation. We're the lead aircraft. And as we went into the toward the landing zone, here are these gunships, and they're shooting rockets, and you can hear machine gun fire and all this other kind of stuff. And you know, the thing that went through my mind, and it's to this day, it still goes through my mind, is I was thinking, this is just like I've seen it on Walter Cronkite. It's just like being on Walter Cronkite, except it's panorama. You know, because I could look, and everywhere I looked, there was war going on. And, I mean, rockets were going off, and there was, you know, and it was just, everything was going on. It's just that kind of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard to imagine. We went to the LZ, and the guys jump off the aircraft, and I'm hearing pop, pop, boom, boom, and, you know, rat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat, and all this other kind of stuff, and I don't know what's going on. I have no earthly conception of what is going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the... am I making any sense?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm... And this is happening. I found out later that, yeah, that was a hot LZ, and yes, you were being shot at, you know, and no, we didn't get hit, and and that, but you don't know, you know, but I guarantee you I found a can of spray paint and painted my helmet OD, because they kept saying, no, white is not the right color, you know, it's just not too good a target.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so big that I could turn my head inside of it.
Oh.
And I got some pads for that and all that, you know. But you learn.
Mm-hmm.
You learn.
But they threw you right into the thick of it.
Oh, yeah. And I wasn't the only one. Don't misunderstand.
Yeah.
Everybody was thrown into it just mm-hmm. that quickly.
Mm-hmm.
It was just the way it was done. Mm-hmm. There was supposed to be some training. There wasn't. But, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Can I say?
Now, they didn't have a checklist for you to use to prep the aircraft?
A Huey comes with all kinds of paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
And in that paperwork, there are books, and there's called a dash 10.
Mm-hmm.
The dash 10 is things that, you know. But as a practical matter, you find out that most of those things are missing from the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
When you get to the aircraft, especially if it's an aircraft that's been out in the field for any period of time, they come with a toolkit. It's been scavenged, if it's even there at all. They come with a lot of things, but that stuff is just not there. Yeah, I had a dash 10. I had the green book sitting right in front of me, but it didn't have anything in it that would pertain to me. It had a lot of pilot stuff in it. I mean, you know, a lot of things that they need,
mm-hmm.
but it didn't have anything that pertained to me. And the question is, why didn't it? Well, because I wasn't on a new aircraft.
Right.
Number one, that aircraft had been out in the field for quite a while. And number two, even on new aircraft that we got in from time to time, all of that stuff was gathered up by maintenance and kept either back in on K, or if we had a maintenance nearby, it was kept there.
So you went in, dropped off the infantry, went back to the headquarters.
Right. And waited, and then later on we extracted.
Was it a hot extraction or cold?
You know, I've thought about that a couple of times. I don't think so. No,
okay.
No. In fact, that's an interesting question. We rarely had. What I would call hot extractions. They were not the norm.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they were... I think a lot of people are under the impression that insertions and extractions generally were under fire. I'd say that's the exception.
Mm-hmm.
Most insertions and most extractions are really quite tame affairs. Now, I have a set of pictures that were made up near Duck Foe. We got called. I
we were waiting to extract our blues one day, and they said, "We got to go now." And I didn't have my weapon, anything. Jumped in the aircraft, and all I had was my camera. And I took some pictures of a hot extraction. And we went in totally unarmed. I didn't have anything. And I have a series of pictures of that whole extraction with the guys running toward the aircraft and everything. And all of the fire that was going on, a lot of burned area, a lot of flames and all this other kind of stuff. That's really the only action series that I've got. There are slides that I took. But the norm was, if you received any fire in an insertion, it was not really the usual thing. It was kind of, you just didn't normally receive fire in an insertion because it was usually pretty well suppressed. Extractions were usually, they were the tame affairs. Because the danger in the extraction was that you would get into an LZ that was too tight. The guys would jump on board the aircraft and you wouldn't have enough room to get into translation and get out. That was the real concern in most extractions. When you did have a hot LZ, things got very interesting. But as in, I can't speak from great experience here, but it has been my experience that in a combat situation, things happen so rapidly and so chaotically that what you do is reactive. It's usually a reaction based upon your training, but or your experience. But things are so chaotic and happening so rapidly that you don't have time to reflect on these things. Now this is happening and this is the action that I'm going to take. You just don't have that opportunity. I've been in those situations, not that many times, but a few times, and I think that most of the things that you do are either instinctive or reactive. I don't know whether I'm making sense or not. Mm-hmm. I hope so.
Yeah, you are.
I've heard other people say pretty much the same thing. Once you have been in that environment, once you have been in a situation where other people are trying to kill you, not you, but where they are actively firing at you,
mm-hmm.
You would think, well, maybe I'll get used to it. You never do. There is no such thing as getting used to it. You may get to the point where you react a little bit better,
mm-hmm.
perhaps a little bit more. Your reactions are a little bit more effective, but I don't think that you can train for that. I don't believe that you can actually train people for that. This is off the subject, but you see a SWAT team, okay. And these guys are highly trained and highly motivated and all this other kind of stuff. And my reaction to that is, bullshit, they haven't been shot at. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So let's wait until they get shot at and mm-hmm. see what they do in effect.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a whole different world. I don't know.
Well,
I may not be explaining it very well.
No, I think you are. Speaking of being highly motivated, what was the morale like in the troop and in the unit generally when you arrived?
I don't think any of us thought in terms of morale. I think I think that the spirit of the guys I'm talking about, the way people felt about things, mm-hmm. was more or less acceptance and if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it as well as I know how.
Okay.
I know that there were some pilots, crew chiefs, ground troops, and we had all three in my unit, who were gung-ho. Mm-hmm. I mean, these guys were guys that were out there to be natural-born killers. You know what I'm talking about? They were out there to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And you also had guys that were very reticent about doing anything. They were, I would never use the word cowardice, but they were super cautious.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then I think there were the people that were, well, this is where I am, this is what I've got to do, and I'm going to try to do it as well as I can. And I think I fell kind of in that range,
mm-hmm.
in this sense. That helicopter was my responsibility. And every day, there were two pilots and nine other troops that were going to be climbing on that aircraft, including me. So I wanted to make sure it ran.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And my aircraft was never down for maintenance. When my aircraft was needed, it was flying. So, and I think that a lot of people felt that way. It's not a question of good morale. It's a question of, well, this is what we've got to do,
mm-hmm.
and so let's just do it, get it over with. Am I making
absolutely
okay?
What was the relationship like between the enlisted men and the warrant officers and officers of the unit?
My relationships were always very good. And to the best of my knowledge, the relationships between... I never knew of any friction. There were the natural tensions between human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some officers that were better officers than others were officers. And that includes the warrants. Because we didn't treat a warrant was an officer as far as we were concerned, and everybody was really treated pretty much the same as far as officer class, enlisted class. But in our particular unit, while there was clearly that distinction, they relied upon us, we relied upon them. There was a very, very good working relationship, and in a lot of cases, very good personal relationship. One of the best friends that I've got today is my own pilot. I mean, I don't see him that often, maybe two or three, maybe a couple of times a year.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a good person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that most of these people were good people.
Mm-hmm.
They were just good people. And on both sides, officers and enlisted men. We didn't have a lot of tension in that regard. There were a few, we had a couple of officers that were assholes, but we had some enlisted people that were exactly the same way.
Mm-hmm.
The distinction was always there,
mm-hmm.
but it's very gratifying when your pilot walks out and he says, is that aircraft ready to go? And yeah, let's go. And he just gets in the aircraft and goes without any question whatsoever. But by the same token, I would get in the aircraft with him. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And I have flown in some really bad stuff with him.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, it's a trusting type situation. And these things have to develop over a period of time.
What about the relationship between the junior enlisted and especially the draftees and the volunteers that were volunteers because they were impending to be drafted, and the senior NCOs or the career-oriented NCOs?
I've heard that question asked before, and I
I would say very little in my experience. The U.S.'s, the draftees, and the RAs like me, we were treated the same. Now, if you were an RA back in the States, an RA tended to get a little bit better assignment than a U.S. That's just a given. But in Vietnam, I think everybody was treated pretty much the same. I really do. Between the junior NCOs and the senior professional type NCOs, there may have been some distinctions that I wasn't aware of, because at the time I was a Spec 4, which is not up in the NCO grade. I made Spec 5 when I came back and began to be treated as an NCO, and then for a while I was wearing Staff Sergeant stripes. They were temporary. I was the manager of the Fort Campbell Flying Club, and I began to see a little bit of that was a different level. E6 begins to be that level where you are now sort of you're in the Army. In other words, it's a day-to-day type job, as opposed to I'm here for a temporary time and I'm getting out. And I began to see that, and there's a difference in the way that E6s and above are treated. But in Vietnam, I wasn't aware of it. Really wasn't aware of it.
While we're on the issue of morale, I also wanted to ask about any kind of ethnic tension or racial tension.
I'm sure there was.
Mm-hmm.
We did not have... we had a mix of white guys like me and some Hispanics and some blacks. I can't tell you that there was any outward tension. In fact, well, no, pardon me. I'll go back. I'll make a flat statement. There was no outward tension, nothing that manifested itself. And I'm talking about there were no fights. There wasn't any of this or that and the other that was a manifestation of racial tension that I'm aware of. I didn't see it. I know that there was an underlying feeling of... among some of the black guys, and maybe some of the Hispanics, put down, maybe, or just not being accepted, or I don't know, whatever word you want to use, prejudice, whatever, among. They felt inferior some way, or that they were treated in an inferior way. You never came across it in my unit in Vietnam overtly, but every now and then you get a little feeling, nothing spoken, no actions, no nothing. But I think it was an undercurrent that was there but it wasn't strong. We had a couple of black guys that were, I mean, they were real ethnic, you know, but which is fine. That's fine. But I just I didn't see that, and I always knew. I always felt if my aircraft goes down, they will be there. There was no question in my mind. The first guy that I carried off field was a black guy. You knew it was there, but it just wasn't something that I could put my finger on. I can't give you any examples.
Okay.
And I've thought a lot about that, because you used to hear a lot about it. Now, back in the States, that was an entirely different thing. But on a day-to-day basis, in a
at least a situation where people are from time to time in combat, or at least are maybe on the verge of being there. They get along quite well. Am I making sense?
What was different about being stateside duty with regard to this issue of racial?
The black troops tended to in the states tended to stay with their own. The Hispanics tended to stay with their own. The white guys tended to stay with their own.
So self-segregation.
It was kind of a self-segregation type thing. On the job, on a day-to-day basis, everybody worked together and everybody did their job, just as they would in the Army anywhere. But there was that feeling, there was that self-segregation, and yeah, that's a very good term, self-segregation in the States. There were certain EM clubs that white guys didn't go in. Or, you know, and you could go in there, but you just weren't welcome there. You knew it was not where you were supposed to be. And there were certain EM clubs that black guys didn't go in because they just knew that they weren't welcome there. You know? The atmosphere was different. The music was different. The language was different. Certainly the look was different. You know what I'm saying? So you just didn't go there. It wasn't that you couldn't be there, but that you just really weren't welcome. It's all right with me. I didn't have any problem with that. It's just not something that I gave a lot of thought to. I don't know, but I have given a lot of thought since then, because I've had people ask that question, and I still don't know how to answer it.
One last question. How about the relationship between aircraft crews and the ground unit guys and the troop? The guys that were going in and getting dropped off. Now, what was your relationship like with them?
Well, I think our relationship in my unit was unique. It was very, very good. I cannot speak to other units. For instance, if you had an ordinary aviation company with a bunch of lift aircrafts and they went in and picked up a bunch of ground troops over here that they did not work with on a day-to-day basis and carried them over to an LZ and dropped them off, the guys that are on the ground watching the aircraft go away could be a little bit unhappy about that. Okay, fine. But in our unit, the infantry platoon, what we call the Blues, were integral to those lift aircraft. They were just another part of our unit. We took them in, we took them out. If they were in trouble, we supported them. If they were wounded, we picked them up. If they were dead, we carried them out. We and they were the same. Now, they may have been on the ground, but we knew that we could wind up on the ground too. You know, and they knew that their way of getting out of there was with us. Everybody took care of everybody else. I don't mean it was not something that you talked about, but it was something that you knew. And so our relationship between our crew, flight crews, and the troops that we put on the ground was very good. These were guys that we knew. I called them by name. They called me by name. They knew that I was flying on that aircraft. And they knew that I would be there when it time came to get them out. They came out to the same aircraft day after day, do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, yes.
It was an entirely different relationship. We saw them. We stood guard duty with these guys, so it was not the same relationship as an unknown aircraft picking up an unknown bunch of guys, putting them in or taking them out. They were us and we were them.
You had good unit cohesion?
We had very good unit cohesion. I thought very good unit cohesion. And on those occasions when we would lose an aircraft and have a crew on the ground, whether they were alive or whether they were dead, our Blues never hesitated to go in and get that air crew. Never. And by the same token, if our Blues were under fire and they had to be extracted, we took them out. And it's just that simple. We did not call in medevac. We never used medevac. We picked our own people up. And it was just, so that made for a real good interface between the ground troops and the flight crews.
Mm-hmm.
And they would, I've had the, you know, ground guys come down and say, what is it that you do, you know? And I'd take them up on top of the aircraft and open up stuff, unbutton mm-hmm. stuff, and, you know. And I've been on the ground. I have gone in on the ground with our Blues mm-hmm. and taken a little walk in the woods upon occasion. Didn't like to do that, but I did it a few times because I wanted to know what that was like too, see. So there was a very, very good relationship between our air crews and the ground troops. I can't speak to other units because you got to remember the 1st Squadron of the 9th Cavalry was a very unique organization. It had its own I call it an armed helicopter reconnaissance unit mm-hmm. with an integral ground platoon. And when I say integral, I mean they were part of us. And sometimes we'd go out on a mission where you'd have a scout aircraft on down low, a red ship with guns above, and a platoon of in a lift aircraft up here. They'd make contact. We'd put a squad on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
They'd do a little recon. We'd go in and pick them up, single ship operation with all, you know, like 3 aircraft going out and doing this sort of stuff. And it's like a reconnaissance. It was a cavalry unit,
mm-hmm.
and these guys were like cavalrymen.
Mm-hmm.
If you know, mm-hmm. they were reconnaissance.
Do you recall your unit's call signs?
Yes, a couple of them. We had Saber was one of them. I think that's what they were when I left. We were Charger when I first got there. And there was something else. I've forgotten what it was now. But for a time I was Charger Blue 36 Charlie, which is Charger being B Troop, first of the night, Blue being, you know, the section,
mm-hmm.
and 36 being my aircraft identification, that which was the number 2, Charlie being the crew chief. And so that's the way that. And when I left, I think we were Saber.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much.
You bet.
This ends the first interview with Mr. Earl Hobbs.
This is Steve Maxter continuing the interview with Mr. Earl Hobbs on the 31st of January 2001 at approximately 9:10 Lubbock time. Mr. Hobbs is in Alta, New Mexico. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and this is a telephone interview. Okay, sir, why don't you go ahead and discuss briefly the Hungarians? You said you wanted to clarify some information about the Hungarians who moved in with your grandparents.
Well, you had asked me a question about if I remembered anything about the Hungarian Revolution, which was in 1956, if I recall. And I had told you that my grandmother and grandfather on my mother's side had some people living there from Hungary, living with them from Hungary. But apparently they came there sometime before the revolution, and I was unable to find out the reasons why, but it really didn't have anything to do with the Hungarian Revolution, so I just wanted to clarify that. I remember the revolution, and I remember it because of these people, but they were not there with my grandmother and grandfather because of the revolution.
Okay, good enough. Why don't we go ahead and pick up then with some of your Vietnam War experiences, and if you could, why don't you go ahead and discuss some of the first operations and missions that you remember?
Well, the very first operation that I remember was the first actual day that I was in the field. I was in B Troop, 1st Squadron of the 9th Cavalry, which was part of the 1st Cavalry Division, and the troop was camped at a place called, I believe, LZ Hammond, which was very close by the newly or being built Phu Cat Air Force Base, which is northwest of Quy Nhon. And my first actual combat operation was the first day that I was in country. It was a hot insertion in an LZ, I think someplace up to the northwest of Phu Cat in, uh, I think, an area that was called the Crow's Foot, if I'm not mistaken. And I just have a very strong memory of that particular operation because it was my second ride in a helicopter, and I had absolutely no idea what I was supposed to be doing. And great, I think I may have said this last time. It was like being on Walter Cronkite. I remember watching pictures of operations in Vietnam on the CBS News with him, and then there I was all of a sudden, and it made quite an impression on me. We inserted the troops, and it was a hot LZ. I could remember the gunfire and the live rounds and the guys jumping off the aircraft and laying on the ground, and we were just in the LZ for a very, very, very short time. And when we got back, I had no idea what was actually going on, so I asked my pilot, who was a captain named Higginbotham, and I said, was that really what I thought it was? Was that live fire and so forth and so on? And he says, sure as hell was. And we had kind of a lively discussion about it. And it was the first thing right out of the bat. So made an impression on me.
Mm-hmm.
We went in later the same day and picked up our troops. The people that we were inserting was our
right.
Blues,
mm-hmm.
which was an integral infantry platoon that was part of the troop.
Okay.
What can I tell you beyond that?
Well, that's good. I was interested in any other operations that you conducted. Did you move around very much?
Oh yeah.
In terms of your base location?
We moved a lot. We were at, I believe the name of the place was Hammond. I said that, but I think it was called Hammond.
Mm-hmm.
We're there for a few weeks, and I can't tell you the times. You got to remember that's going on 33 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
We went from Hammond to an area west of Pleiku. That was in in the Central Highlands, much higher elevation. Hammond was down almost at sea level, northwest of Quignon, which is very close. Quignon's on the coast, major port city. From Hammond, we went to what we called Plantation,
mm-hmm.
and Plantation west of Pleiku was up in the Central Highlands. The terrain was entirely different. The vegetation was a lot different. Plantation was I remember the red dirt there that we had to, it was just an entirely different area. We set up camp there, and were there several weeks. We conducted operations in that area. There was a tea plantation close by, had tea and rubber trees that had been a French operation, I guess, back when it was French Indochina. And we would drive through that area every now and then on our way to Pleiku. I made that trip just to drive a couple of times in the back of a deuce and a half just for the heck of it, when my aircraft would be down for maintenance or something like that. It was a very, very pretty country. To the south and southwest of Plantation was the Special Forces camp called Play Me. There had been a very big battle at Play Me not too long before we got there, where the NVA had tried to overrun Play Me. There was also to the southwest of Plantation was the Chupang Massif, the Iadrang Valley and the Chupang Massif, where the 1st and the 9th had initiated the famous Battle of the Iadrang, and where our Colonel Stockton, the original squadron commander, had been relieved of his command because he didn't follow some orders, or at least he kind of went beyond his orders. And that was where the 7th Cavalry got in some really deep trouble fighting the 33rd North Vietnamese Regiment. And that was the 33rd was the regiment that we were always on the lookout for there in that area. They were definitely there, and we were definitely involved in a lot of operations trying to seek them out and see search and destroy type operations. So I spent quite a bit of time down at Play Me and with the troop. We would logger there in the daytime and then go back to plantation in the evenings. A lot of insertions, small firefights, a lot of scouting activities, that sort of thing, all around the Chupang and the Idrang and to the. We even once or twice. That's the area where Cambodia and Laos kind of meet in a triangle there with Vietnam, and we would occasionally cross that border. We weren't supposed to be crossing the border, of course, but I know for a fact that we did on two or three times. One evening, my aircraft inserted some long range patrols, LRPs. They call them LRRP. People way to the west. It was a nighttime insertion, single ship type operation. Kind of made me a little bit nervous, but nighttime operation, and we went way out to the west. And I know we were someplace right along that Cambodian Laotian line, probably well west of the Vietnamese border out there. So we had a lot of operations in that area. Then,
sir, I'm sorry.
Sir?
Just to clarify, did you say you were west into Cambodia or west into Laos?
West. I'm not sure whether it was Cambodia or Laos. I know that line was right in there someplace,
okay.
and that's been so long ago, Steve.
Okay.
I just
curious.
I can't tell you whether we were northwest into Cambodia, I mean into Laos, or west, straight west into Cambodia. I can't tell you.
Okay.
Crew chiefs didn't ordinarily, you know, we didn't have the map with us. So I don't know. I can't tell you precisely.
I completely understand.
We also had some kind of detached operations to the north of Play Ku up toward a beautiful little town called Kontum, which was it looked like a little French, like something right out of a postcard, a little French village sitting on a river bend. And then we had some more detached operations a little further up at a place called Doc To, which, of course, had some rather heavy fighting at a later point. From Plantation, we were there for a few weeks. The troop was there. Then we moved to the Bong Son Plain. And I've always been just a little bit confused about the names of our LZs out in there. There were two of them, our base camps out in that area. But I think one of them was LZ 2 Bits, if I remember correctly. We were there for several weeks conducting operations around the in the Bong Son Plain to the west and southwest into the Crow's Foot and the Onlo Valley. I believe it's Onlo Valley. Yeah, Onlo, through up the Onlo River. And then... from the Bong Son Plain, and that was Bong Son, was where there was a major LZ near there, LZ English, right in the middle of the Bong Son Plain, north of the river, pretty much adjacent to Highway 1. We would spend some time there. That was our major fueling point and armament point, that sort of thing. From Bong Son, we moved north to a place called Duc Pho, D-U-C-P-H-O, Duc Pho. And at Duc Pho, the troop was operating detached from the 1st Cavalry Division, and we were part of the, I think there were some people there from the 101st, or maybe it was the 173rd Airborne. I've forgotten who it was exactly, but later on that was consolidated into an area where the AmeriCal division operated. We were at Duc Pho, to give you a time frame, in before April and into May and possibly even June of 67. So from Hammond to Plantation, Plantation to Bong Son Plain, I think that was two bits. Then back up to Duck Foe into the spring, late spring and early summer of 67. And that was where the very, very famous picture was taken of the troops jumping out of, my pilot thinks it was my aircraft, and I'm not sure whether it was ours or not, of the troops unloading from the H model Huey on the side of the hill at out west of Duck Foe. It's a very famous picture. I'm sure you've seen it. And then we were there operating for a while out also along the coastline, and which is just a beautiful part of the country. And then south again down to the Bong Son Plain in the middle of the summer, I guess it was, maybe June or July. And we were there until I came home in middle of September of 67. So the major operations that I was involved in were, I would say mostly the major operations were in the southwest of Pleiku, mm-hmm. and also in the Duck Foe area, and west of Duck Foe, and then in the Bong Son Plain.
Okay.
Now, I've forgotten the names of the operations. I wrote them out for you there on those answers. And frankly, now that I'm just sitting here with no paper in front of me, I don't remember them. Some of them were Thayer, and I'd have to go back and look those up. I've got the CAV history in my files over there someplace, but I'd have to go back and look those up. September of 66 into September of 67. And we would stay our troop would stay in a camp for anywhere from just like 3-4 weeks all the way up to maybe 2 or 3 months. What can I tell you now?
Okay. Well, that was good. I was curious. You mentioned during some of your operations, you had taken some pictures. Do you still have those photographs? Or
yes, I do. I have some of most of the pictures that I took were in and around camps, mm-hmm. And some airborne operations. Mm-hmm. When I say airborne, you know, I'm talking about in the air, that sort of thing. I have a few pictures of. I don't have any real combat operations. You have to understand. It was kind of frowned on to be taking pictures when you needed to be on your weapon.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I started off when I first got to Duck Foe, mm-hmm. I started off in the lift section, which was the slick aircraft, as a crew chief, and then I gravitated from there over to being a machine gunner, crew chief and machine gunner in what we called our red aircraft.
Oh, okay.
And I did that for a while. I was not a very good machine gunner, but I managed to keep my weapon operational. Then I spent a little bit of time, just a tiny bit of time, as an observer on scout aircraft, and that was really not I was not much cut out for that. I didn't see the things on the ground that I was supposed to see, and I just wasn't very good at it. Went back to red gunships for a while, and finally, I spent most of my time in the lift aircraft, and so I spent I'd say the majority of my time was in the lift aircraft, what we call blue.
Yes, sir.
So that's where I was. I was not. I wasn't really the warrior type, you know. I was pretty happy in the lift aircraft.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you guys ever lift others besides your own internal infantry units? Did you carry any Arvin or other U.S. troops around or Allied troops?
We carried our own troops probably 90% of the time, and occasionally we would carry someone else, usually other American units, and that was very rare. A few times we did carry some Arvin. A few times we did carry some Koreans. I remember out in the plantation area, there were some ROK troops out there, and they were really hardcore. I think I mentioned this last time. We had one incident that came to mind where with some Vietnamese indigenous personnel, they weren't very well motivated and very well led, and it got pretty hostile trying to even get them off the aircraft. Mm-hmm. So, we had some interactions with Vietnamese, not very much, but some. And I don't want to give you the impression that the Vietnamese were worthless. They also had some really good troops. Now, down at Play Me, there were some Vietnamese troops that they're pretty much hardcore. They were willing to get out there and really get into the operationals a lot. Mm-hmm. But by and large, they weren't much. Koreans, boy, I'm telling you, those were some tough people, they were hard on themselves and hard on everybody else too. They were really tough.
Well, the Arvin troops, did you ever have any experiences? I've been told a story by a couple of other veterans that basically sometimes when you would take out Arvin, if you went back to pick them up, it wouldn't be completely unknown or unheard of to get shot at by those troops, that there might have been VC or whatever that infiltrated an Arvin unit, and basically they were just waiting for you to come back to ambush.
I heard stories like that. We never experienced anything like that. The stories that I heard were something, and I give some credence to this story. I understand over in A Troop, which was one of our sister units, that they inserted some Arvin one day, and as they left the LZ, the Arvin were shooting at them because they didn't want to be left behind. I don't know whether that's true or not, but I give it some credence. I think it's entirely possible. I never experienced anything like that. Yeah. Don't know. Now, I do know of one situation, and I think I told you about it last time, where a crew chief had to level his pistol directly at an Arvin lieutenant, mm-hmm. and I know that for a fact. I heard it from three separate sources, and I know that for a fact just to get him off the aircraft.
Right. Yeah, you did mention that before.
And that really stood out in my mind, you know, because ordinarily when you went into an LZ, you wanted to unass that aircraft as fast as possible.
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned earlier that long-range reconnaissance patrol you guys inserted into somewhere.
Yes.
How often did you ever do that again, or was that the only time?
We did that a few times. It was always a blue aircraft, and it was nearly always a single ship operation at night. Uh-huh. And treetop level at night is very interesting, especially when there's an overcast. We did that a few times. I don't recall any other operations that far to the west. But from where Plantation was located, which, again, I can't give you specifics on this, but if you look at the map from Pleiku, imagine about halfway to the Vietnamese border is about where Plantation was, which is not very far. And then we would fly, 45 minutes or so to the west, which would place us well inside either Cambodia or Laos, and my best judgment is that we were in Laos, and we just never really discussed these things. We just did them. You know what I mean? You got to remember, crew chief is the low man on the totem pole, and you just get on the aircraft and do what you're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know a lot about those operations, but yeah, we inserted LERPs several times, and they were nearly always nighttime insertions. And We also did one other thing. Are you interested in people sniffer operations?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
We did that for a while. That was a worthless piece of garbage. They came out one day and said, we're going to put a people sniffer on your aircraft. And I think they had selected one of the other aircraft too. They put this proboscis, I'll call it, on the front of my aircraft, which was it was a ram air type thing. Mm-hmm. Ran this thing back up into between the pilot and the co-pilot's seat, past the console, and there was a great big box. It was about I don't know how big. I mean what the exact dimensions, but it was man-sized box, this thing in there, and it was a people sniffer. Now the premise was that if you were flying along at treetop level, if there was an enemy camp or something like that underneath you, it would smell the smells of people. I assume ordinary human excretions, urine and all of that kind of stuff, and body smells and the smell of cooking and all this other kind of stuff. And of course, it took a few seconds for this to register on the machine, so you're already back. You're already down the mm-hmm. down some ways from it. But they had apparently had some way of getting that. There was a printout that came out. It was like a graph, piece of graph paper or something that came out. And it would tell you where these people were. Well, my aircraft would be down on the ground, right down on the treetops, and we'd be flying along in a straight line, and all of a sudden we'd register something. So we'd make a loop around, come back, and fly over this same area, and of course, after you passed it, it would register again. They would begin to find out where they suspected there were encampments of people down in under the trees. We would always have a pair of gunships up on top of us, and they would, if we found something, well, then they'd go in and try to find. You know, they'd strafe the area with the machine gun fire or rockets, or if they found anything. And it was a hope and wish type operation, and I thought it was totally and completely useless. But at least you were right down there amongst the trees; you weren't going to get shot at. If you did get shot at, it would be very, very short exposure. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a bad deal. It was just totally worthless. But we did that.
Did you ever uncover any unit? Any enemy units? Or?
Not to my knowledge. Not anything directly related to that, no. I have no knowledge that we ever got diddly squat out of it. Huh? Mm. But they did that we had those on there for, I don't know how long, maybe a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And then they disappeared as quickly as they came in. The maintenance people came over one day and yanked them off the aircraft, and we went back to regular operations. And I think that the reason that they put them on the, I think I was flying a D model at that time, mm-hmm. and the reason was it had a larger place to put the machinery. Mm. It wasn't heavy; it just needed a little bit more room that you could put in a B model or a Charlie model.
Mm-hmm. Well, how far out did that proboscis stick out from the front of the aircraft?
I don't remember. I've thought about that several times, and I wish I'd taken a picture of one of those machines. It was kind of an air scoop out in front, just like a scoop. And I don't think it stuck out there a long ways, but it was under the chin. You know, on a Huey, there's a clamshell door in the front mm-hmm. of it that opens up where the battery compartment and radio compartment is.
Yes, sir.
And I think it was underneath that. I really don't remember too much about it.
You don't remember if it stuck out to the beyond the nose of the aircraft? Or?
I think it probably came out even with the nose of the aircraft, or maybe a little bit beyond it. But that wouldn't be that very far. That would only be like maybe at the most a couple of feet.
Yes, sir.
But I don't recall. It was just an air scoop, was really mm-hmm. what it was. It was, and then this stuff was ducked past the pilot and co-pilot right. up through the floor there. They just took out some panels, and it was really kind of a straightforward plumbing mm-hmm. job.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just curious because it seems to me that the rotor wash would have a very powerful effect on something like that.
No, it wouldn't. because once you're moving forward, you are in, once a helicopter reaches a certain speed, it's about 10 to 15 knots. It moves into what's called translation.
Okay.
And at that point, the air in front of the aircraft is clean. It's not affected by the rotor wash. It's an air a helicopter flies either in a hovering mode or it moves forward into translation. The translation is almost like an airplane type flight.
Right, where the rotor actually becomes a blade.
Yes. Yeah, and it's that's the only way I know how to describe it to you. I'm not a helicopter.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, pilot. But no, that air is once the aircraft is up to about 15 or 20 knots, it's in clean air out there.
Okay.
And of course, a Huey, a D model Huey cruises at about 95 knots approximately. So it's well out in clean air.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Very interesting. Now the LRP insertions that you did. How long did they usually stay out, and did you also go back and pick them up?
We did go back and pick them up two or three times. I don't recall how many times, but yes. How long did they stay out? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
We had attached to the 1st Squadron of the 9th Cav a... I think these guys were Ranger-type people. Who did LRP operations, and it was a small detachment, and we did not have a lot to do with them, just occasionally insert them, or they would maybe overnight with us every now and then. Really can't tell you about that. The operations that, for instance, if we inserted somebody, we didn't know if we were going to go back and pick them up or if somebody else was going to go back and pick them up. We had no idea when we would do it. We did go out a few times and extract them, and those were daylight extractions. Usually an early morning or a late afternoon, very late afternoon extractions. But that was just, it was not a common operation. We did it a few times.
Okay. And there were never hot extractions?
No. I don't ever recall any of these LRP operations as being hot. In fact, that would have been the worst possible thing was for them to be anywhere near any kind of, you know, firefight. Now, I do know, I've heard stories of LRP operations where these guys would get in trouble and have to be extracted, you know, on a very short notice. But I have I never had anything like that happen.
Okay. Were there any other operations that you recall?
Well,
particular interest or?
I don't think I ever really explained to you. We had three colors of aircraft. We had our the whites, which were H-13. They were the scout aircraft, H-13s, old Bell bubble canopy reciprocating engine helicopters. They were the scout aircraft operating in pairs. They were white teams. And they operated down low and slow. Their purpose was to look for Charlie they scouted the area. That was their purpose. Then we had red aircraft, which were a Huey B model and C model aircraft, which were the gunships. They operated in pairs and operated much the same as the scout aircraft, and also provided cover for the scout aircraft when they would find themselves under fire. And then we had an infantry platoon, what we call the Blues, and we had four aircraft that carried the Blues, which we would insert. And they, after contact was made with the enemy, if our sixth, the commanding officer, decided it was appropriate, he would insert the Blues to be on the ground and try to make contact with the enemy and assess the strength of the enemy. They would sometimes do little small search and destroy operations, some ambush operations, that sort of thing. So that was the three types of aircraft. And I spent some time on the red aircraft, a little while on scouts trying to learn how to do that, and I just wasn't really very suited for it. And then most of my time on the Blue aircraft as a lift aircraft crew chief and gunner. Okay. So I wanted to clarify that because I don't think I ever really said what our operations were.
Right.
We were I call it an armed helicopter reconnaissance squadron. Mm-hmm. That's what it was.
And by and large, those major operations that you were a part of, these were, in general, you know, the sweep and clear, fix and destroy type of missions, correct?
Yes. The usual purpose of B Troop was to go out and find the enemy. Mm-hmm. Our B Troop, A Troop, and C Troop, we went out and found the enemy and ascertained the strength of the enemy, their positions, that sort of thing. And once contact had been made, we would maintain that contact until a larger force of infantry could be put on the ground. Okay. Then our troops were withdrawn. Okay. We would extract our people. And the reason for that was that our guys went in very light. Almost never did they, rarely did they stay on the ground overnight. Mm-hmm. And even when they did, it was only because we couldn't get them out. We always tried to get our people off the ground at night. They were very lightly armed and didn't carry anything basically except water and ammunition. So they just didn't have the ability to stay on the ground overnight.
Okay.
And it was a small platoon. When I say platoon, 21 or 22 men was about the most that we would field at any one time, putting them on the ground. And a couple of times, the blue platoon leader was always a lieutenant. Well, I think it might have been a captain once or twice, but a blue platoon leader. They let me go on the ground with them if my aircraft was down for maintenance or something like that. Well, I went for a little walk in the woods with them a few times. I want to tell you, that was the hardest job. Mm-hmm. They had my full respect, I'll guarantee you that.
Did they ever make contact when you were with them?
Yes.
What was the unit, the enemy's strength, do you recall?
At most, squad. I was with them one time out west of... west of Bongsan, out west of Tubitz, in a little upper little river valley, I believe it's the Onlo River, and they saw some people running away from us, armed, and there was a little firefight. It was not a major firefight of any sort. It was mostly a matter of I think it was probably a VC unit. They didn't look like they had black pajamas as opposed to green uniforms. So I would say that it was probably a VC unit, and they were trying to get away from us as fast as they could. And there was some small arms fire back and forth. No heavy weapons or anything like that. And I was scared to death, so I can't tell you too much about it. I got on the ground as quick as I could and stayed there. I'm not sure I even fired my weapon. But it was that happened once out in the Onlo Valley, and another time we were going through a little village, or a little, I guess more of an encampment type village west of Duck Foe when I was with them on the ground there. And we received some fire, more like sniper fire than anything else, no automatic weapons fire, but rifle fire from, it seemed like, from pretty good distance. And our guys went toward the fire. We all went that direction, and it just kind of stopped, and that was it. So, yeah, I was involved in a couple of firefights on the ground, but nothing ever very heavy. Received some fire when at night. We would always have nearly always you pull some guard duty at night. Crew chiefs were not exempt from guard duty, and several times I've received weapons fire at night during, you know, with guard duty.
Okay. And let's see. When the, what was when you mentioned that the primary mission of the unit was to go in, make, find the enemy, make initial contact, and then allow for a larger unit to come in. What was the largest unit the troop ever encountered while you were flying with them?
That's a very interesting question, and I think you have to you'd have to assess. You don't just go in and find a whole regiment of troops. You don't just right. land right on top of them. I mean, that's the rare exception, and if you did, you wouldn't survive. I think the largest. Largest single organization that we ever encountered was probably a regimental size operation, North Vietnamese regimental size operation, and that was probably out west of Duc Pho, my best judgment. Now that's while I was there. But what you're doing there is you're scouting around and trying to locate the enemy in scouting the area of operation. What you're actually going to encounter is the fringes right. of the enemy movement, and usually they did not want to make contact with you. You know you could be over them, and unless they had an overwhelming strength, they weren't going to attack you because they knew that they could, that they were going to have a much stronger force brought in on top of them. Mm-hmm. So I can't tell you precisely, but I believe we did encounter a regimental size operation to the west of Duc Pho, which is probably the largest unit we ever encountered that I have personal knowledge of.
Yeah. What was the largest enemy weapon fired at your aircraft while you were flying?
Probably the equivalent of a 50 caliber. I think it was a 12.7 millimeter machine gun that they had. I don't believe my aircraft was ever hit by that kind of fire, mm-hmm. but I believe that based upon the sounds that I heard and what I was told. That to listen for and just general experience as you get more experience flying. I know that I was in the vicinity of a 12.7 one day, and I know that they had to have been shooting in our direction.
Yeah.
I can't tell you. I don't have any bullet holes to show.
Yeah.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. And was your aircraft or any of the other aircraft in your troop shot down?
Yes, sir. Many times.
Yours or?
We lost quite a few aircraft to enemy fire. My aircraft was downed also. Yeah.
Okay. And was it downed in friendly or enemy territory?
Let's just say semi. Yeah, we got our troops around it very very quickly, and they provided us good cover, and we got our aircraft out. But yes, we lost quite a few aircraft to enemy fire. We lost quite a few scout shifts, quite a few red shifts. We lost a couple of lift shifts to enemy fire. Yeah.
And what was the casualty rate like for your unit? Did you guys take a lot of injured or killed?
It depended. Steve, I wish I could give you figures on it.
Okay.
I just can't give you. I can give you a feeling for
yeah.
it.
Yeah. What was your impression?
My impression was that we lost. In infantry personnel, probably 25%. In crew chiefs, gunners, and pilots, we lost probably in the range of 20%. And I'm not talking about I'm talking about dead and or wounded.
Okay.
So I'm just kind of pulling those numbers out of my head, but I think that I would be well in the ballpark that crew chiefs, machine gunners, and pilots, one in five had a pretty good probability of getting, of being injured sufficiently that they would be out of the troop for a period of time. And I'm also including killed. We did lose, we lost several crews. I say several. We lost a few crews when I was, whole crews, an aircraft, and one particular incident comes to mind. You might not be interested in the long war story here, but
oh yeah, go ahead.
I have a very, very close friend that, and this is a hard story for me to tell, I guess. But
do you want to take a break?
No, I'm fine.
Okay.
He swapped off with another friend on an aircraft one day. I don't have any earthly idea, but Gil swapped off with another guy, and the other man was flying his aircraft when and apparently they went over the aircraft flew over a bunker of some sort, and the Vietnamese blew up the bunker. They had it booby trapped, I guess, and the whole belly of the aircraft was just blown away, and of course the aircraft landed upside down, and all four guys on board were killed: pilot, co-pilot, crew chief, and gunner. Mm-hmm. They found the aircraft after, I guess it was the second or the third day, but let's just say the second day. They located the aircraft in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. Put our blues on the ground and secured the area, and then brought in a Chinook to lift the aircraft out. They got three of the bodies out of the aircraft before they lifted it out. The body of the crew chief was wedged in where they couldn't get him out. So they lifted this aircraft back to our base camp, and it was I still have this picture in my mind. Gil stood under that aircraft, and they lowered that thing down on top of him, and he cut that body out of the aircraft, carried it away.
Let's take a break.
No, the point I wanted to make was that I know that to this day, and I have talked to Gil about this, and he feels like he should have been on that aircraft. Mm-hmm. And it was a very, very emotional experience, I think,
yes,
for him.
Absolutely.
And for the rest of us that knew everybody on the aircraft.
Right.
You know, so, and it was not that was a particular incident. We had other things like that happened, and it's just a part of combat operations. That's all there is to it.
Yes, sir.
Now, pardon me, I'll get on with it.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and talk about any other operations that come to mind.
Well, I don't have. Let me just go back to from one base camp to the next. From Hammond,
mm-hmm.
At Hammond, I don't have an awful lot of memories of the Hammond area because I was new and just beginning to learn the job and that sort of thing. I can't tell you too much. Out in the Pleiku area. West of Pleiku, when we were at Plantation, I found that a lot more interesting area. The terrain was very interesting. Lots of heavily forested area and lots of open, I'd call it almost scrubland type area. The operational area itself around in the Idrang and the Chupong area down around Play Me was historically quite scary to us because it was the area where the 1st of the 9th had really gotten into its first heavy operations after the CAV got there in 65. And you want to remember this would have been right at the end of 66, beginning of 67, in the Christmas time frame there. So all of a sudden, I think our power is going on and off here at the house. You'll have to use that. It probably makes a clicking sound on the phone. The operational area there was kind of, I'd say, scary, especially at night. It seems to me that I was more afraid of enemy attacks on our perimeter at out there at Plantation than any other time, because it was such an open area, and our perimeter was not as well fortified as it usually was. When we got over toward Bongsan, our perimeters were very heavily fortified, and lots of concertina wire, and we would clear the areas for open fields of fire. Had just a lot better security, so the night times were not as scary as they were out toward Plantation. At Duck Fo, we were operating with a larger unit. We were in a big base camp there with part of a brigade of infantry, and so we did not have to provide a lot of our own security, and the area was very well secured. That is, the base camp was very well secured. There was one funny incident I'll tell you about, extremely funny. At Duck Fo, it was the area along the seacoast there is a plain, and there was a small mountain, almost a cone-shaped mountain that rises right up out of that plain, and that's where the base camp was, and we were on the southwest side of that. That's where our base camp was, on the southwest side of that mountain. When we had gotten there, the Marines had just moved off that mountain, and they had mined the mountain, had a observation post up on top of it, and they had mined the mountain, and they lost the key to the minefield. So they didn't know where the mines were. So the Army brought in a bulldozer with one of these, with a great big huge blade out in front of it, and this bulldozer went up that mountainside carving a path. And every now and then it would hit a mine, and it was just absolutely hilarious. So you'd go up and you'd hear this bulldozer roaring along there, and out, and a big, huge bang, and there'd be a big cloud of dust and gray smoke and everything else, and then bulldozer would keep going up a little bit further, and carving this little road or path up to the top. He went all the way around the mountain, and it was just kind of humorous because the Marines had lost the key to the minefield. Nobody knew where the mines were located, and I guess they were using those anti-personnel mines that were made out of plastic.
Mm-hmm.
And that'd be a big bang. So mm-hmm. we didn't think too much of the Marines at that particular point. In the meantime, we supplied that little observation post up on top with some with their goodies, and took people on and off and that sort of thing until they got the path up the mountain built.
Okay.
It was kind of humorous. Very pretty area around Duck Fo. Beautiful white beaches. Water was just as clear and blue as it could be, and we'd fly last light missions at night up and down that coast, and you'd see all kinds of things that a kid from West Texas didn't see.
Yes, sir. Okay. Any other operations you recall from Duck Fo?
Well, of course, I told you there's a very famous picture of the operations, and I've got, if you'll hang on, hold on just a second here. I'm going to put the phone down just for a minute.
Okay.
Okay, I'm back on the phone here. There's a picture that was made, and I want to get it for you so that you can look it up if you're interested.
Mm-hmm.
It's a squad, and I'm reading from the caption on the picture. It's a squad of the Blue Rifle platoon, B Troop, 1st Squadron, 9th Cavalry, dismount a UH-1D on the 24th of April, 1967. Photograph was taken by Staff Sergeant Howard C. Breedlove during Operation Oregon out west of Duck Fo in Quang Nai Province. And I don't have the Army picture number on it. But it's a very, very famous picture. And
are you looking at a copy of the picture itself? Or
yes,
it
I am.
In a book somewhere?
I'm looking at a copy of the picture itself.
Okay.
And you've seen this picture. Well, the funny part about it was we've had all kinds of fights break out, little verbal battles
mm-hmm.
break out, trying to figure out which one of these aircraft it is.
Hmm.
But we know that it has to be one of four aircraft. and we recognized the people getting on and off the aircraft. In fact, one of the boys that's standing on the side with his rifle up in the air was later killed. And we know who it is, but we don't know, we know who all these people are. We can identify them. The guy on the captain on the ground is a fellow named Ted Chilcott. Know him well. Mm-hmm. We all know who these people are, but we cannot figure out which aircraft it is. But I think that it might be mine because it has a patch that I had replaced on the bottom behind the pilot's below and to the rear of the pilot's door.
Mm-hmm.
So we think, my pilot and I think it's our aircraft, but one of the other guys thinks it's his. It's just very, very, very difficult to tell.
Mm-hmm.
But it's for sure us.
Okay.
You know what I mean? It's our outfit, and it's a famous picture.
Yeah.
That's probably my only claim to fame, as a matter of fact. Make a long story short, yeah, we had a lot of operations out in the area around Duck Foe that were we were detached at that time from the first Cavalry Division, and we're operating with, I think I keep wanting to say the 173rd, but I know that's probably not correct. I'm sorry, I'm getting off the track here.
No,
what was your
okay.
question?
No, you're talking about it. Just the different operations and stuff that you did while you were at Duck Foe.
While we were at Duck Foe, I said we did, you know, we would do the last light missions, mm-hmm. Flying out over the coast. And I just remember, a lot of the things that I remember about Vietnam were how pretty the countryside was, and things that I had never seen before. Of course, coming from West Texas, I had not been associated with the ocean very much, so flying around seashores and that sort of thing was very interesting. The coastline was just very pretty there, beautiful white beaches. And of course, if you went out on the beach to pick up some guys, the sand would just do terrible things to your aircraft. Get inside any bearings that you had and everything else. So you didn't want to operate along on the coast very much, especially landing and taking off from the coast on the beach. That's just bad on aircraft. Pretty country there in the Pleiku area. Very, very pretty country. I would mention the little town around of Con Tum. It was just like a little French village, and
mm-hmm.
pretty country. Waterfalls, hidden waterfalls up little valleys with these three-tiered canopy forests that you'd read about them in books, and you'd think, well, I'm never going to go see things like that, but there you were flying over it, and it was beautiful country. And sometimes it just didn't seem like a war zone. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And then something, of course, would intrude on the, but it was very pretty countryside. I didn't care too much for the towns. They were dirty and mm-hmm. very primitive, but I did not have to spend much time around the towns. So we were always out in the field. And occasionally we would go maybe ride through a town in a truck or something like that if you were going to the garbage dump or something, but that was about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything else you want to talk about?
Operationally?
Well, with regard to your time in Vietnam.
No, not really. I think I've tried to give you mm-hmm. a fairly clear picture of what I did and
mm-hmm.
and the kind of operations that we did, and I think that's pretty. I think I pretty well covered it.
Okay. Well, what was it like leaving, and what was it like to arrive in the United States?
Leaving the country was very abrupt. That, in fact, that's a very good word, was abrupt. We there were three or four of us that got there at the same time, and we left on the same time. I was told, of course, I knew when my time to go back was, and I didn't want to leave the field immediately. I did not want to go back into ONK, because if you went back into ONK, you were liable to get assigned to, you know, details of one thing or of one type or another. So we avoided going back into ONK until just the last moment. And believe it or not, the day that we were supposed to leave in the afternoon, leave ONK and fly down to, I guess it was Tan Son Nhut, I was still flying missions up until that morning. They had located I guess some of our red ships had located some weapons, NVA weapons, and enemy troops out near the pass between Ankay and Quinyon. And they got kind of an ad hoc bunch of us, and we jumped on board aircraft and went out, and we were flying missions that morning before I left. So when I left country, it was quite abrupt. And came back, put on my khakis, and we got on the airplane, rode down to Tan Sanut, if I remember correctly. I believe that's where we left from. And flew home. It was, a charter flight. And to tell you the truth, I don't remember too much about the flight home. Mostly night, mm-hmm. and not too much. I think everybody was just kind of subdued and glad mm-hmm. to be out of country. Got to Seattle, was where we came in at, I've forgotten what it is. Got off the aircraft in our khakis, and some guys were still in fatigues. Mm-hmm. Got off the aircraft, were bused to it's Fort Lewis, Washington, and we were bused, I believe, out to Fort Lewis, and they ran us through a very efficient operation. You went in one door and came out the other door in greens, and everything was on your uniforms, all your patches and everything was on your uniform. They even reissued all of your ribbons, everything that you were supposed to have. You got a complete issue of just about everything. And it was one of the few times I've seen the Army really do something very efficiently, because we were in and out of there in like two or three hours. And shaved and showered and cleaned up I had to fight to hang on to my cavalry hat, because I had a Stetson that we were all 1st Squadron of the 9th Cavalry wore Stetsons, and they said that wasn't a authorized hat, but I managed to hang on to that, and I still got it sitting over here in my closet to this day. And had to hang on to that, wore my cavalry hat home, mm-hmm. I was kind of proud of that. But anyway, mm-hmm. They took us by bus over to Seattle-Tacoma Airport, and caught a Braniff flight, and it was a 727 nighttime flight from it went from SeaTac to Portland. It was a big long trip. Portland to Dallas Love Field. That's where Dallas Love was open in those days for Braniff Airline. And then from Braniff there to Lubbock. Got off the airplane wearing my cavalry hat, and my folks met me, and everybody met me. My girlfriend. At that time she was in Germany, and so I spent a few days at home, and then went to Germany, mm-hmm. and had a rather long leave in Germany. As far as you always hear about these stories about the bad reception that people got when they came home. Mm-hmm. I did not encounter any of that. In 67 it was a little bit early for the protest to have taken, any organized shape. Heard some other guys say that they were not treated very friendly, but I was well received coming home. Mm-hmm. And my mother and dad were big in the Baptist church in Lubbock, and our church made a big deal about me coming home, and all mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. I don't have any bad memories about coming home. Mm-hmm. I stayed home a few days, and then I went to Germany, and I spent, I want to remember 54 days. I had a lot of accumulated leave. Mm-hmm. and the Army let me take that. Spent 54 days with my girlfriend over there. We traveled up and down the Rhine, and she was enrolled in the study of, I believe they call it Germanistik, which is the immersion in the whole German culture. Mm-hmm. And she and I traveled up and down there. We spent in and around the Hamburg area, and down around Munster and Westphalia, and down toward Freiburg and Breisgau, and into Switzerland some. She was in the University of Freiburg, I believe, was where she was enrolled. And had a good old time, came back and reported into Fort Campbell, Kentucky. That was my duty station.
Okay. And how much more time did you have left in service?
About a year.
Okay.
And I spent that year at Fort Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
I did do one short TDY return to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
It's really not that big a deal. It was just a TDY thing, and I just did not get into that. But
how long did it last?
About 90 days.
And is it something that you don't want to talk about because of classification, or is it just something that...
I'm not real comfortable talking about it, and it was during the Tet situation, and I'd just rather not, Steve.
Okay. Good enough. And let's see. Was the transition at all difficult for you in terms of going from Vietnam back to the United States and... in a military combat environment to being in a civilian environment?
No, I don't think so. When you get to Vietnam, the general army experience, let's just talk about that for a second. When you are in a training environment or you're in the States, everything is very measured, very cadenced, very structured. When I got into the combat environment in Vietnam, it was an entirely different thing. Certainly, you were still in the military. Certainly, it was the Army. Certainly, it had the military, all of the military disciplines. But it was more a work environment. You did your job, and everyone worked quite well together. Officers and enlisted men, we had that distinction, but there was this environment of working together and working for each other. Do you understand what I mean? When you come back to the States, back into the military environment in the States, it becomes, again, very, very structured, very cadenced, very regimented. That was the big difference. Being back in the States was, of course, a great relief, but I didn't mind. I enjoyed my time at Fort Campbell. In fact, I had a very good job there.
Mm-hmm.
I was made the manager of the Fort Campbell Flying Club because I had all my pilot's licenses.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave me temporary orders as an E-6. And I was drawing quarters and rations and living off post. I didn't have to go back on post except to pick up my pay and occasionally go in and report to the first sergeant and tell him what the hell I was doing, because they always like to know. And so I had a very good thing.
Mm-hmm.
At Fort Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
And my last year at Fort Campbell, really last 9 months or so at Fort Campbell, was just fine.
Mm-hmm.
I had no problems with it.
Okay.
And I was kind of living high on the hog, to tell you the truth, because
mm-hmm.
I was also, when I was managing the flying club, if I was giving instruction, well, I would just pocket that money.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked away from Fort Campbell with a pretty nice little bankroll.
Wow. Okay. Well, and then after your year at Fort Campbell, you got out and came back to Lubbock?
Got out, came back to Lubbock. Yeah.
Okay. Well, why don't we go ahead and discuss some of the ways the Vietnam War has been important to you? In what way or ways has your experience as a Vietnam veteran affected you most?
Well, I had always lived, I grew up in a very comfortable, very sheltered environment. I grew up, I guess you could say, pretty privileged in many respects. And the Army, and in particular Vietnam, was a great growing up experience to me. I would not wish combat a war. I would not wish a war off on anybody. But I think that it was good for me. Do you know what I'm saying? Because it made me grow up. And so in that respect, I'm very appreciative, not of the war, but of the things that of the way I grew up. Another thing is that, and I don't know how to explain this to you. It's a difficult thing to explain. If I had to go to Vietnam, I am very grateful that I was in the unit that I was in, that I was in a real day-to-day combat-prone environment. I am grateful for that because I don't think it was the same experience as someone who went as, let's say, a clerk typist or a quartermaster or something along those lines. Do you understand what I'm saying? I'm grateful that I had the experience that I had. Not that I would wish it off on anybody else, and I would not want to go back and do it again. Mm-hmm. But I am grateful for the experience. And I've talked to some of the other guys in the last. I did not in any way participate in any kind of veterans organizations at all until about 19, probably 91 or 2. Mm-hmm. So there was a long interval in there when I did not participate in anything. I guess I was a member of the Vietnam veterans, but I didn't participate in anything. Mm-hmm. And long about that time frame, I began to kind of began to talk to some of these people, and I think a lot of people feel the same way that I do. Is if you had to be there, it was better to be a part of it, mm-hmm, than sort of on the outside looking in. Right. Am I explaining that well enough?
Very well.
Okay.
What did you think about the how the war came to a conclusion? And really, I mean, you got to look back to after Tet, Johnson's decision not to run for re-election, Nixon's Vietnamization, our pullout with the Paris Peace in 73, and then the fall in 75. Now, what did you think as those events unfolded?
Well, that's a broad question. I tell you what, I've forgotten where it was, but I watched Lyndon Johnson make his speech that night, and when he said, he would not accept, you know, and so forth. And I think everybody was just, you know, flabbergasted. I mean, just couldn't even begin to imagine that that he wouldn't run for president again. I mean, just I'm not sure how to answer your question. I think that if we had prosecuted the war, I love that term, if we had fought the war, prosecuted the war to the full extent of our capabilities, I believe the outcome would have been different. I think the war was very, very badly handled politically, and I think it was badly handled militarily. Mm-hmm. That's just a, you know, everybody's entitled to their own dumbass opinion. I think Nixon was, I think he was flat-ass lying through his teeth when he said he had a plan. I think his plan was to do whatever it was politically expedient. Johnson was he was a politician who should have just left the war up to the generals. I think the war was very badly handled. That's the way I would say it.
Okay. Now you said that you thought that it should have been fought to the fullest extent of our capability, to include nuclear?
No, I don't think that would have been necessary. I just don't think it would have been necessary. But let me give you an example, and of course, I was a lowly crew chief on one aircraft out of thousands, and I don't. My perspective is rather limited. But here, my point is this: if we were going to wage war, let's wage war. The thing about we're not going to bomb certain areas of Hanoi, or we're not going to attack certain targets, or we're not going to engage the enemy except under certain conditions, we'll put this area off limits and we'll only conduct operations over in this area. I think that was the wrong strategy. If you're going to fight a war, fight a war. If you're going to, there's nothing pleasant about war. If you're going to fight it, you fight it with every available means, and you don't pull your punches. You don't want to get in a fight in the first place, but if you're in a fight, then you do exactly what you have to do to win that war. That's my point. I think that we were in the war, I think, for the right motives, but our ally in the war, the Vietnamese, were not well motivated, they were not well led, and they were politically and morally corrupt. I don't have anything good to say about the Vietnamese. So that's my viewpoint. I don't want to tell you a war story, but I'll tell you a little story. Mm-hmm. And you've probably heard this from other people, but it is the absolute truth. Mm-hmm. I have been in a situation where we were receiving fire on our aircraft, and we were told, do not return fire, those may be friendlies. Now, think about that. That's just stupid. You know that you're under fire, you know where the enemy is, and you're told, don't return fire. That's ridiculous.
How often did that happen?
In my case, exactly once. But I know that it has happened. I factually know. I could give you names of people that it happened to in other situations. Mm-hmm. But in my case, in the case of my aircraft, one time. Mm. And we had them on the ground. We could see the weapons. They were shooting at us, but we couldn't return fire. They told us do not do that.
Were the rules of engagement for your unit restrictive in other ways?
No. In fact, I would say that the rules of engagement within my unit were very loose. I do not recall any occasion when I did not have an open gun. Mm-hmm. With that one situation.
Okay.
In fact, I always had an open gun. I kind of got myself in trouble one day. We had just inserted some troops, our Blues. And as we came out about maybe a quarter of a mile away from where we'd inserted the Blues, we were still at very low altitude, and we went right across a little pagoda, and I saw this guy with a rifle, and he was running away from the pagoda, and I opened up on him and didn't tell my pilot what I was fixing to do. I just opened up on him, and I was screaming into the microphone, turn to the left, and they got real excited because there wasn't supposed to be any fire on that particular mission. There was expected to be a completely cold LZ, and it was just a kind of a walk in the woods type situation. I think I got everybody all excited. So my pilot kind of jumped on me that day. He said, "If you're going to do that, let me know."
<All right. laughs>
So But anyway, but I had already opened up on the guy, and he was, I don't think I came anywhere close to him, but I opened up and was screaming into the microphone, turn to the left, turn to the left, and they circled, and the guy disappeared into the woods. And mm-hmm. I don't know whether they ever found anything or not.
And when you say you had an open weapon, you're talking about rounds chambered, safety off.
Oh, yeah. And
ready to go.
As far as, you know, when I say open weapon, I mean you were on your own responsibility.
Right, and your finger was on the trigger, ready to fire.
I was ready to go. Yeah, well, I don't know about your finger
on
the trigger, but the answer is yes. We kept our weapons were locked and loaded, you bet.
Right, okay.
In fact, in my unit, in B Troop, you were expected, even in base camp, you carried your weapon.
Mm-hmm.
We had our weapon at all times, and on the aircraft. And once the trigger was pulled to crank up the engines, we were locked and loaded.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and with good reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are the lessons we as a country should take away from the Vietnam War?
I think I said it pretty as well as I could say it a couple of minutes ago. If you're going to fight a war, fight a war. I think we made a mistake by going into that thing not prepared. I think we were prepared militarily to fight it, but we were not prepared politically to fight it. And I don't think we were prepared emotionally as a country to fight it. It was a war that we probably were fighting for the right reasons, but we were not well motivated to fight it.
Mm-hmm.
The country wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether we could have ever been made that way. That's a a question for debate. I guess it'll go on for hundreds of years. But we could have fought the war much more effectively. Mm-hmm. I think Westmoreland and his people were bad commanders. I really do.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about today?
No. I think I've told you pretty much how I feel about things,
mm-hmm.
and what we did. If you have any other questions, I wish I could expand, but I'm not really sure what you'd want to know, Steve.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, why don't we go ahead and end the interview for today then? This will end the second interview with Mr. Earl Hobbs.